reload this week's news with Charlie Meyerson and Rumana Hussein, Chicago actor Michael Patrick Thornton, and another installment of Reality Check with Tracy Swartz. And now, here's your host, a man who spent most of the day complaining about the sun, Justin Kaufman.
It's just too bright. It's too hot. It's too warm, the sun. Gosh, I wish it was February. Welcome to the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. No, I take it back. I love the sun. What an impossibly beautiful day. I mean, it really was. I mean, this is really a precursor to what is going to be a rainy, crappy weekend. Although, what do I know? I'm not a meteorologist. And frankly, every time I think that I have any schmidget of confidence about the weather, it's wrong. I thought last week I was already planning to watch all of the Harry Potter movies again and do everything indoors, and then it was beautiful the whole weekend.
It seems like my app on my phone, the weather changes every couple of hours.
Yeah. And that's we made that joke a little bit earlier in the week, just this idea that if we can't trust our iPhones with that information, I mean, it used to be like, well, maybe it was the TV weatherman, you know, maybe it was on him. There's that famous scene in L.A. Story where Steve Martin tapes the weather ahead of time. Like, what's the worst that could happen? But the iPhone can't lie. And yet it's wrong.
Who's predicting? What little guy is in the phone predicting?
It's Tim Skilling. It's a different. it's a guy. They've created a little mini robot of Skilling that's in your phone. All right. We got a great show lined up tonight. Whether or not you're heading out of town or just sitting at home on the porch after a great week of work, or perhaps like us, you're starting work and you work the weekends, we got you here on the download. I always love Friday nights. Got that feel of people trying to get out of town or feel like they've accomplished something or getting ready to accomplish something. It's a good day, and it's a better night. And you can see it on the street right here in front of us in Michigan Avenue, where it's just a lot of people enjoying themselves going shoulder to shoulder. It's a great day when the street performers even get together. You know, earlier I saw Spider-Man, Iron Man, the Gorilla, all choreographed, dancing together on Michigan Avenue. You know, if it wasn't such a great day, maybe they'd all go to different corners, but they thought there's something joyous about it. Let's all get together. You know, be as one, as the song says. Tonight we reload this week's news. I'm very excited to have Charlie Meyerson and Rumana Hussein in studio tonight to reload the news. What's the biggest story? What's the overreported, underreported? Winners, losers? What story sucked you down the rabbit hole? And which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 50, 500 years from this week? As we said, oh, I think I have an idea what it's going to be. I'm living underwater. That's going to be it. 312-981-7200. You can also text in or call in and play along with the reloading of this week's news coming up at 8 o'clock. But before that, Sam Panianovich is going to join us, talk about the UIC Flames and their bid to try and make the College World Series. They're in the regionals down in Mississippi. They were dealt a little bit of a blow today, but it's a double elimination tournament. They just made it a little bit harder for themselves. We'll talk to Sam about that, but also about the NBA Finals, which we kind of watched out of the corner of our eye last night. And every time I looked over, I'm like, well, it's a 20-point lead. We'll talk about whether or not we will see anything different from the results coming up the next game and, of course, when it goes back to Cleveland. So we'll talk with Sam. Coming up a little bit later, Tracy Swartz joins us. There's a new segment, Reality Check, to talk about the reality shows that have Chicago components. Bachelorette, how did our Chicago guys do this week? Pete, you just told me you watched the show.
Oh, yeah.
I don't watch it. I missed it. I feel like I've been knee-deep in reading about the Tet Offensive, 1968, the Battle of Hue.
You do the heavy work.
Yeah, I'm reading that.
And I'll do the light work. Well,
he's coming on for LitFest, and I read 300 pages of that. I feel like, and it's also kind of messing with my head because I feel like the way the discipline has been for the download, I'll read the book up to the point where I do the interview. So I feel like I did 250 pages of prep for tonight's show. Like, all I want to do in the reload tonight is talk about the war in Vietnam. And it's not for another week because I have to get ahead because there's so many books coming in through LitFest. I really have, like, a discipline where I only have really one more half day with this book, and then I got to move on to the other books that are coming through. But, wow. Wow. I mean, it's a great book. So I'm excited to talk. I didn't know a lot about that stuff. I'm, you know, obviously I was born in early 70s, missed the Vietnam War, knew a lot about it from pop culture and movies from the 80s. Mm-hmm. As Ro pointed out, the Battle of Hawaii was Full Metal Jacket, the end of that movie. But this is a historical document. I mean, what Bowden's put together is pretty interesting, so... We'll talk with him coming up LitFest next week. Not tonight.
A lot of books.
So we'll talk. But you've got The Bachelorette. You got that unlocked.
Got that covered,
all right,
yeah.
Good. You can do that while I...
I think the 31 contestants total probably have not read 300 pages.
You can talk with Tracy while I go eat my Costco chicken burrito bowl that I still have sitting on my desk that I didn't get a chance to eat.
Every time I come down and I smell that thing, I was like, oh, man, I'm like a cartoon. You know, I'm floating towards the...
It's good. It's good and plasticky. It's got a good plasticky feel to it. So that's coming up. Also tonight, Michael Patrick Thornton, Claire Keisha will be here from the Gift Theater, and we'll talk about their new play that they're premiering next week. Michael Patrick Thornton, one of the first guests ever on The Download, so... We'll have him back on the show a little bit later in the show, maybe 10 o'clock hour. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Roger Badish. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, let's get this show on the road. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. The City of Chicago and the Department of Justice have agreed on an independent monitor to oversee the Chicago Police Department. This is not the usual course of action when we talk about the consent decree, which means a judge would oversee the implementation of reform. No, this is different and a little bit unclear, which is because it was a leaked story on a Friday night in the summer, maybe. Does this mean there won't be a consent decree? Does the independent monitor replace Superintendent Eddie Johnson? Will the new boss put more cops on Segways? I just think that's a cool idea. It'd be more fun for everybody. I'm sure we'll hear more about this story as it becomes public on somebody else's time. In a recent interview, Russian President Vladimir Putin said that if it could have been Russian hackers who hacked the DNC emails, but they weren't Russia. So it could be Russian hackers, just not Russia. And you know what? That kind of makes sense. When Ferris Bueller hacked into the school mainframe to change his grades, he was acting in his own interest. He wasn't the Americans, right? Grace! Also, at least Putin brings us back to reality a bit and maybe shakes this weird 80s-like obsession with saying the Russians over and over and over, conjuring up an Arnold Schwarzenegger in Red Heat, which means all of us Americans would be Jim Belushi. Let that sink in. So, is Putin right? Is it possible the election was hacked by independent bad guys? Or am I once again being manipulated? Again. Always. Yeah. A new graph is circulating the internet talking about the size of certain industries that would be saved by a move to pull out of the Paris Accord. Of course, I'm talking coal. There are roughly 76,000 people working in that industry. To give you an idea of scale, 100,000 work in the travel agency business, 150,000 in the car wash industry, and 90,000 in terrestrial radio. I mean, would you choose talk radio over saving the planet? Well, wait, maybe you should. I mean, with internet and podcasts, I am the forgotten American. Where's my red hat? Do I get one? I don't. As I predicted yesterday, as quick as President Trump touted a positive direction for the economy, a new report is out today saying that the economy is slowing. The Labor Department statistics say that job growth is down from April and below predictions, but our unemployment rate is at the lowest point since 2001. Now I wait for President Trump to say that's fake because of the people who just gave up. Oh, we're not doing that anymore. That's so 2016. We're gonna say that the unemployment numbers are the best ever now. Yeah, okay, got it. Just making sure. The White House doesn't seem to care about the job growth number, and economists say that the unemployment number is not that great of news either because it essentially means everyone that wants a job has one. So what's the truth? Is the economy getting better or is it getting worse? I don't know. Wait till tomorrow to see if a new report comes out. That's actually it. Economy reporting is just a smidge worse than housing reporting. The housing market's up. No, it's not. It's down. Then it's up. No, you know what? You're reading it wrong. It's down. That's housing reporting every single week. Kathy Griffin says her career is over after she posted a picture with her and a beheaded bloody head of President Trump. Really? I would have thought it was over after fashion police. But she's lawyered up and she's blaming Trump and his family for bullying her and taking away her earning potential, which is definitely a new one. But was Trump tweeting about his disgust as a celebrity or as a president? And does that matter? Ooh, I feel precedent coming on. I think the moral of the story is don't do any poses with bloody heads of presidents. And if you're a president, get someone else to take on these battles. Right? In weather? Yeah, it's on. Right? It's on. But it's going to rain tomorrow. Oh, it's off. Maybe. In sports, see, everything's getting back to normal. The Cubs beat the Cardinals in game one of a three-game set this afternoon, 3-2. It was Jason Hayward who played hero with a couple RBIs, and Wade Davis locked it down. Also, Dexter Fowler back at Wrigley Field leading off with a solo shot just to help us remember. The White Sox kick off a three-game set in Detroit. This after last weekend where the Sox took 3 of 4 at the G-rate. The G-spot. Do we like the G-spot? What are we calling it? Do we not figure that out yet? They should get Dre and Snoop involved. Nothing but a G thing. Figure something out. They could probably work it out. The Sox need a strong showing this week in at least 2 of 3 just to keep us interested. The Sox turned to ace Derek Holland, who promptly gave up 8 runs in the first 3 innings tonight. So, yeah. Don't look now, but the MLB draft is on June 12th, and the Sox have the 11th pick. Nice. Load them up. I've been saying it. The 2024 White Sox, they might be dope. In college baseball, UIC lost to Southern Miss in the first round of their regional. They still have a shot to win, but it's going to be tough. And if they win, they get an invite to the College World Series in Omaha. That Holiday Inn's going to be a jam. Haven't talked much about the Chicago Sky since Elena Deladon left via trade to Washington. Well, they made the sports roundup last night by giving up a WNBA record 8 3-pointers to Diana Taurasi in Phoenix. Just like the Sky drew it up. In football news, they aren't even playing and the Bears continue to get hurt. Cam Meredith, one of the wide receivers the Bears need to have a big year from, injured his thumb and he won't be back on the field till sometime during training camp. It's almost too funny to laugh. Does John Fox practice with moving turfs and hacksaws? Why do the Bears seem to get hurt more than everybody else? I have nothing to back up that assertion, but doesn't that seem about right? Also, the Kansas City Chiefs released Jeremy Maclin today. There you go. Let's get that guy. Maclin, Cruz, and then just get rid of everybody else. The NBA Finals picked back up Sunday after last night's blowout win for the Warriors. What's with all the spacing of the games waiting for the finals? I get it, NBA. You want to milk the ratings as much as possible, but come on. These guys play over 100 games a season, usually every other day. It's about rhythm, not about selling more Kias. Well, I guess it is about selling Kias. It's basketball after all. Then they don't play again until Wednesday. What? At this rate, the NBA Finals will be a doubleheader with next year's preseason games. Game 6 of the Warriors, the Warriors-Cavs coming up. Timberwolves-Lakers. Oh. And finally, this may be a fitting cap to the week's news. Over 10,000 people claimed to be at the Ariana Grande show that was attacked in Manchester so they could get free tickets to the tribute show. Ugh! I mean, I get it. Justin Bieber's going to be there, but still. Ugh! Gross! Tweet about that, Trump. Sad, pathetic, loser. Those are your buzzwords. I'll retweet. All right, that's the carryout for June 2nd, 2017. Hey, it's National Donut Day. And, well, we made a lot of donuts this morning. So now get ready for National Stale Donut Night. Coming up. Sam Penyanovich is going to join us from Mississippi to talk about the College World Series, and we'll reload this week's news, biggest stories, winners, losers, and which story we're going to remember in 5,500 years from this week. It's a download. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
How about those UIC Flames, huh?
Yeah, they got to. I mean, they're making it tough for themselves.
Yeah.
But they could do it.
I mean,
they want to be an underdog story. This is the way to go about it.
Yeah. Well, Hattiesburg, Mississippi. You know. I don't know what goes on down there.
Yeah, I don't know why.
I'm sure there's something.
Verbal reaction to that.
Yeah.
I was just noticing, and I was kind of making a joke in the carryout, that they are spreading these NBA Finals games out. Like, they get 3 days off between each game.
Well, the NBA's doing it. Hockey's doing it. I mean, let's get on with it.
I mean, they played last night, Thursday, and they're not going to play again till what? Did I say Monday?
Sunday. NBA Final, yeah.
Friday, so they get two games off, and they're not switching stadiums.
Well, Thursday, yeah. Friday, Saturday, yeah. So, you know, the third day in, and then the hockey's doing something similar as well. And I would like to know at the league level in both leagues what the rationale is for that.
It must be that they want certain nights, right? They must love Sunday night.
Okay.
They're trying to get there, and maybe hockey loves Saturday night. Or maybe they don't want to play on the same nights, you know, to...
Well, that I get. You know, I mean, you know, alternate nights, it's fine.
Right.
And I've long argued, and it's just too long. 162 for baseball, 82 for NBA and hockey. Just cut them all down. Just cut the whole season down. It's ridiculous.
You see? Just like the College World Series. Just get a couple regionals and get right to it.
Boom.
There you go. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, we got some sports to talk about on this Friday. Not necessarily your standard story about the NBA Finals or the Cubs beating the Cardinals or the Sox, whatever they're doing right now in the fourth inning down 10-3. No, this is about college baseball, the regionals that could lead the UIC Flames to the College World Series are underway in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Today, the UIC Flames, the number 4 seed in the tournament, the regional, was taking on the number 1 Southern Miss and almost came out with the win, losing 8-7. This doesn't necessarily eliminate them. It's a double elimination tournament, but it makes things a lot tougher. Sam Panionovich is on the line with WGN Radio Sports. Also calls games for the UIC Flames. Sam, a tough loss. They seem to be in the game, but they just couldn't pull it out.
We led 6-1 in the fourth, JK. A grand slam from our All-American catcher made it 6-1. Gave a couple of back in the bottom half, and then our bullpen just got eaten up, the first part of the bullpen. And then we came up in the ninth, bases loaded, 2 outs down a run, and just couldn't get a hit. We fought to the end. We clawed. We scratched. Unfortunately, came up short 8-7. But it's tough to swallow when you're leading 6-1 and then you fall 8-7.
You know, this is the regional in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And if you look at the other teams, you've got a Southern Miss, you got a Mississippi State, you got a South Alabama, and then you got the University of Illinois at Chicago. I mean, it's difficult for the Flames to be traveling in this way and to essentially be playing home games against the rest of the tournament.
Yeah, it was a home game, no doubt, for Southern Miss. And there were 4,200 announced. There were probably about 1,000 more around the perimeter. It was raucous. It was loud. They were playing air horns, which are actually illegal. But it was a home game for Southern Miss. But that's what you get when you're the number 10 team in the country. I will say, though, UIC's been tested all year. I mean, they won a series at Vanderbilt. They were really close in a lot of games at Missouri. So, I mean, that's not an excuse by any means. And you only can play who's in front of you. But this team is certainly battle tested. And I promise you, they will fight tomorrow. We're going to play at 1 o'clock at Pete Taylor Stadium. And I just think that, you know, the resiliency will shine through. I think they'll be fine tomorrow. The only problem is you're in that loser's bracket. So you have to win out. You know, you're up against the wall.
All right, let me ask you this. You know, when it comes to college baseball, is it similar to football or basketball and what we know? I mean, to the teams you mentioned, Vanderbilt and Missouri, they don't necessarily play in the Horizon League. What does UIC do to make sure they're playing big schools and being able to expand their reach in terms of a program?
Well, it all comes down to the scheduling, you know, and the non-conference. And I think that Mike D, he's been here a long time, and he's always thought about, you know, loading up that schedule early. He's not afraid to play anybody, and that's the way you do it. You know, in the Horizon League, you're right, it's not the SEC, it's not the Big Ten, it's not the Big 12, but they load up the schedule early, and they play a lot of games away from home. Then when they come home, they're ready. I mean, when they left Missouri, they came home and they won 24 of their next 26. So this is a Flames team. This is like the best team they've had. They tied a program record for wins. So Mike D and the Flames are not afraid of anybody. They'll play whoever they want. And unfortunately, a lot of those teams don't come to Chicago. We have to go there. But that's just the way the cookie crumbles when you're in the Horizon.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you know, the UIC Flames having a tremendous season on the diamond. How do they stack up to be the only Illinois representative who has a chance to be in the College World Series this year?
Oh, yeah, the only team. Northwestern lost in the title game. Illinois State lost in the title game. UIC is the best college baseball team in 2017, and that says a lot. Now, are they satisfied with going to a regional and not winning a game? Absolutely not. I mean, the goals here were to go to a regional and to win a regional, and that's not out of the question still. But this team, I mean, they do everything right. They pitch the ball. They catch the ball. Unfortunately, had three errors today, but they hit well. I mean, you scored seven runs and were leading the number 10 team in the nation at their place 6-1 in the fourth inning. Nobody saw that coming. So, you know, the next question is, what's the next step? Mm-hmm. You know, you have to string some appearances together. This was the first one since 2008. This team went this year. They want to go next year. And you have to put multiple appearances together. That's the next step for this program.
For college baseball, when I think about college baseball, who are the best teams in the nation? I mean, is it the same that you see in football? And I mean, is it the teams from Texas? Like, who are the teams that are the odds-on favorite to go to Omaha and win the whole thing?
Well, the best team in the country this year was Oregon State. They were 49-4. I don't know how. I don't even know how that's possible. I mean, you mess around and lose 10 games. Oregon State, Stanford, LSU, Southern Miss is number 10. I mean, usually schools that are south of the Mason-Dixon line, because they can play all year round. I mean, they play in January. In Chicago, there's snow from, you know, December through March. So usually warm weather schools. Oregon State's the best, but a lot of California schools, Pac-12 is pretty strong, but you look in that Sun Belt, you know, the Louisiana schools, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, schools like that, and in mm-hmm. North Carolina as well. Usually schools in the south are the best.
Is it hard for a school like UIC playing up in Chicago with a schedule in which there is inclement weather to recruit, to bring people here, to be a respected, well-known, you know, college baseball program?
I don't think it's tough. I mean, because you come to the campus and you've seen pictures, you've been around the campus. If you stand in the batter's box at home plate at UIC, you look out towards center field and you see the skyline, you know, highlighted by the Willis Tower, the artist formerly known as the Sears Tower. It's the best view in college baseball. Facilities are top of the line. They have an indoor turf facility as well. I mean, the equipment, all that stuff is great. It's just not a power conference. And these schools have boosters that just write checks. They write blank checks. And that's the difference between your mid-major schools and your power conferences. We're not going to compete with LSU for recruits, but we do have kids from California. We've got an All-American from New York. We've got kids from Florida and Louisiana and Texas. We get kids from everywhere, but it's the caliber of player. And, you know, there's prestige with these other programs because they go to regionals year in and year out.
What is the strength of the UIC Flames this year? As if we're going to find the game tomorrow and watch them and attempt to cheer them on from Chicago down in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, what's the strength? What should we be looking for?
Number one defense in the country, the number two pitching staff in the country, and we play small ball. You know, we like to lay down a lot of bunts. Sometimes that works out, sometimes it doesn't. But we manufacture runs. We don't have a lot of home run hitters. We play small ball. We get guys on first, bunt them over, and bring them in. But it's a really, really strong fundamental team. They make all the easy plays, and they make the tough plays look easy. So it's not the sexiest style. I mean, we're not going to score 15 runs a game, but we limit our mistakes. And we pitch well. The bullpen's probably the best in the Midwest. So, you know, we're going to fight till the end, too. I mean, 8-7 in the regional, you're right there. So this team won't quit, and that's probably the best attribute.
And that's tomorrow, the next game for them. They'll play the game two loser, the South Alabama versus Mississippi State, tomorrow, 1 o'clock. They win that game, they got a shot to play on Sunday. And then, you know, things got to go their way to keep winning till they get to Monday, the championship game. Sam Panionovic, my guest, he's in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, right now in the regional for the College Baseball World Series, which will take place in Omaha, calling games for the UIC Flames. Let's make a transition. Let's talk about the NBA Finals. Last night, I'm sure you watched from the Hotel 8 or wherever the Motel 8 you were staying at down in Hattiesburg. But what did you think? I mean, it's kind of interesting to see the game that Kevin Durant had all year long. I've been talking about, why did the Warriors need to get this guy? You know, obviously, how does he fit in? And then you watch him play LeBron James in the finals. You're like, oh, that's why.
It's like when you go to the playground and the best player gets to pick, like, the first three guys. That's pretty much what it was, right? I mean, it's like the best four players on the court, and then there's LeBron. It's just, it's so sad that this is what the league has evolved into. You know, I mean, we could talk about this at end, but star players in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, they wanted to be the alpha on their team. And now other guys want to go in different directions and play with their friends. And a line to chase a ring, and it's unfortunate. I mean, Kevin Durant loses to a 73-win team, and then he joins that team in the offseason. I mean, that's a joke. The game wasn't even close. I mean, it was around the 20 to 30 point mark the whole time. I think it's going to be the case the entire series. I'm actually rooting for LeBron. I can't believe I'm saying that. but I mean, it's like pick the lesser of two evils. I mean, I'll put it to you. Are you rooting for either of these teams? Because I'm not.
Well, I mean, it's amazing to watch the firepower of the Golden State Warriors. I mean, to watch Steph Curry be the second or third.
Is it amazing? I mean,
it's kind of cool.
I don't think it's amazing. I think it's a bunch of crap because these guys just come together and, okay, well, we didn't win last year. Let's bring in a top five player in the league. It's pish-posh to me. You know, I don't appreciate the competitive nature of the NBA. Granted, these are the two best teams. It's exciting. Watching the Warriors put up all those points is a lot of fun. But that being said, you talk about parity. There are two teams, maybe only one team, that can win a title. And when that's the case in your sport, that's bad. Look at hockey. The Nashville Predators, 8 seed in the final. That doesn't happen in basketball. The Bulls were the 8 seed. They're not going to the final. That's the issue right now. The top is rich. Everybody else is poor.
You know, I wonder why the Golden State Warriors haven't had as much consternation from fans and from the media about engineering their team in that way, because you remember LeBron and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh got all sorts of negative energy for getting together in Miami to create that super team. Do you feel like the Golden State Warriors get the same amount of trash talk on the fact that they've also sort of done the same thing?
I don't think they get the same. I think Miami had it much worse because remember when they all signed, they had that press, well, not even a press conference. They had the rally where LeBron said, not one, not two, not three, not four, not five. I mean, he was counting like the seven with the amount of titles they were going to win. So they brought that upon themselves. The Warriors are kind of fun, though. I mean, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson. They've got a nice young core. And I think for them, that helps them a lot because most of those guys were drafted by Golden State, the Greens and the Thompsons and the Currys. The only slight is the addition of Durant. So I think it's a lot more organic with the Warriors. They're not nearly as hated as Miami Heat. Remember when Miami came together, they started wearing those all-black uniforms. I mean, they embraced it. Golden State's just kind of going through the motion.
So, you know, as we think about what to see, because there's a chance. I mean, I don't know LeBron James to be the kind of athlete that lets a team blow him out, you know, 20-plus points and then come out and not retaliate. I feel like, is there a possibility we could see, not unlike we did last year, that LeBron James turns it around and maybe steals one in Oakland?
He's going to have to be even better than he was last year. We're talking about a clip that he's going to need to put up of 35 points a game, 12 rebounds a game, 11 assists a game.
Durant,
he's going to need all the help in the world, though. He's going to need Kyle Korver to make open shots. I mean, there were stretches in that game where Cleveland had a chance to take the lead and they just missed open shots. And you know, it's ironic because LeBron left Miami because he wanted more help. He may never get enough help to get over these Warriors, but I think they win a game. I hope they win too. I hope it's competitive. But, I mean, come on. The best five players in the series, go ahead, lay them out there. The best four of the best five are on Golden State, and it's a numbers game at this point.
Do you have any intel on whether or not Steve Kerr is even going to be back on the sideline for this final, or is it just smoke and mirrors and trying to get some sort of psychological advantage and he's not coming back?
I'm not sure. I'm not around Steve Kerr. I've heard the back issues are chronic. I've heard they're very bad. He's had so many procedures go on right now. But honestly, I mean, Justin Kaufman could coach the Warriors and they'd be fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's like an AAU super team. But Mike Brown's been there all year. He's been a coach in the league for a long, long time. And this certainly helps to have a coach with experience at the helm. I don't know. I know Steve Kerr wants to be there, but right now he's having a hard time even sitting down for long periods of time. So he's still there. His messages are still there. They're running his offense, and everything is still hands-on. But he's just not there in a suit when the game goes on. He's been to practice and all that, but the stress of an NBA Finals game is just a little too much for him right now.
Well, if I were coaching the Warriors, there'd be way more burpees. We would do way more layup drills. And we'd be working on our free throws. And I make everybody wear their shorts below the knee. I'd go old school.
Underhanded free throws, too, right? Like
right.
Rick Barry, you
just
kind of flip it up.
Like fundamentals. Sam Fanjanovic.
I picture you with a clipboard and a whistle. That's your mojo.
I have that regardless of coaching basketball. That's what I have on just doing this talk show. Sam Panionovich, WGN Radio Sports in Hattiesburg, Mississippi for the regional for the College World Series. The UIC Flames play tomorrow at 1 o'clock. They got to win that game or they're going home. Sam, thanks for joining us, and go Flames.
I'm in a barbecue coma. Help.
It's Download here on 720 WGN. All right. Good to hear from Sam. A little barbecue coma. Coming up, we reload this week's news. I could never be a basketball coach. You know, I had an old buddy of mine who I used to work with who he coached his, I think it was fifth grade maybe, his fifth grade son in the grade school.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go on Saturdays and watch it because it was like 30 minutes at 10 a.m. You know, so I'd go for support and I'd sit up in the bleachers. And it was just, I mean, the game was like 6-4. If not, I mean, 4-2.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just like kids just scrumming.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there's just no spacing. There's just not. So I feel like that would be the only entree I'd have is to like coach basketball for kids. And I wouldn't have the patience for it. I'd be looking for Steph Curry. I'd be designing plays for kickouts. Pick and roll kickouts, and instead it just be like a bunch, like 8, 10-year-olds just all trying to grab the ball for 45 seconds at a time. If you've ever been to a basketball game for fifth graders, that's exactly what it's like.
Well, you don't want to get involved in coaching a team that your son is not on. That was weird. I had a couple of baseball coaches when I was like 10 and 11 that didn't have kids on the team.
Right.
And you know, they were probably like 22, 23 years old at the time. You thought they were old, but I was like, why are you, your kids not here? Why are you here?
Oh, Little League. Oh, don't get me started. Little League stories. I'm going to write a book about it. I'm going to write a book, and it's going to be all about Little League, Wonder Lake Little League. I had a team. I was just thinking about this the other day, talking about the Warriors rigging or the Miami Heat rigging teams. I had a team, I remember this, where you know, you would have a league would be like a 13-year-old and a 14-year-old, right? So like you would have 13 and 14-year-olds,
right? Yeah.
So you'd have the so the 13-year-olds would play, and then the next year they'd be still in the league.
Yeah.
I had a coach who came in who had figured out a dad who had figured out that if he would have picked the one team, right, he could get his son to play on that team because that's part of you know what the rules are.
Yeah.
He would also get the young players that were coming in. He had two sons, a 13 and a 14-year-old. So he took his 14-year-old son off of my team, put it on his team. So they ended up like just by the, and then what he did was he got his another guy to be the coach of that team, like an assistant, and he pulled his son from a different team to join that team. They're all-stars. So before there was even a draft for the league, there were seven players that were all-stars on that guy's team.
Oh, man.
So that was really frustrating because I wasn't. And I was – this was cocky Justin. This was – the 14-year-old cocky Justin, where like I had like a tight perm, you know, like an 80s perm going with my cool Angels jersey. You know, I was you couldn't tell me what to do. So I just became sort of the bad boy of the league. And we played that team. And they were all my friends, you know, and I was annoyed that, you know, my team had
nobody. Yeah.
And we just got slaughtered, right? And right before the slaughter rule takes effect in the fifth inning, the pitcher, the son of the coach, decides it'd be fun to pitch left-handed.
No way.
Yeah.
Showing you up.
Like, not, I mean, he's not a left-handed. He's right-handed. So the idea is he's going to go left-handed for the fun, and everyone's having fun as he's striking out guys on our team left-handed because he's so athletic. But I was like, where is the, yeah. First of all, where's my coach to be like, you can't do that? Where's the, at the end of the day, the point of, this is just Little League for kids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I remember being so mad that I took my, I forgot what it was called, my BMX bike that I had. And I, like, threw, like, we got up on the hill, and I threw it down the hill, by, like, ghost-rided it down. And, like, it bent and was broken because I was so mad.
Man, did the mag wheels make it out okay?
I think the mag wheels are okay. I can't speak for the grips on the handlebar if they made it out. But, yeah. Yeah, so that they were the Golden State Warriors of Little League.
You never want to be the dad or the parent or whatever that cares that much.
That you rigged the league.
Yeah, that you rigged the league.
You rigged the league. That's ridiculous, right? Don't you think it's ridiculous?
Yeah. Look those kids up on Facebook. I bet you they're horrible people right now. Horrible adults is my prediction.
No, they're good kids. I don't know about the dad, but they're good kids. Thank you, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. It's Friday night, so we reload this week's news. What are the biggest stories? The overreported, the underreported, the winners, the losers. Which story sucked you down the rabbit hole this week, and which story will we remember in 5, 10, 15, 500 years from now, huh? 312-981-7200. We got two great Chicago journalists in studio tonight. Rumana Hussain, the assistant metro editor at the Chicago Sun-Times. Rumana, good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a while. I feel like the last time that we did radio together, you were covering the courts. You were doing criminal,
yep,
right?
Yep, and I just started working as a full-time editor about 3 or 4 months ago. So
congratulations.
Yeah, no there reporting anymore for a bit. But
all right,
I'd like to get back into it at some point.
Well, you got to restart, right?
Yes.
You got to refresh a little bit, then you get back into it. Charlie Meyerson, I don't know if you've ever refreshed. You continue to work and work and work. Charlie Meyerson, and now the editor of the Chicago Public Square, which is the daily newsletter that tells us what's going on in the world, which is up for a Best of Chicago. And what is it?
Yes, Chicago site? Readers, Best of Chicago 2017. We're one of four finalists, which
what's
shocks me as much as everyone else. The best news site.
Okay, I'll go check out Best News Site, and then I'll see Best Cocktail.
That's right. And actually, we're a finalist in that category, too.
You are good, are good. All right, well, you guys are here tonight, and I appreciate it, so let's get right to it. Let's start with the biggest story of the week. Charlie, why don't you start? What do you think of the biggest story of this week?
I would guess the biggest story would have to be something that affects, you know, ideally much of the entire planet Earth, probably something that touches all of us in one way or another, something that crosses.
You can say it, Kathy Griffin. You can say it.
Yeah, Kathy Griffin, that crosses national lines, all hemispheres of the Earth. I don't know. Has there been a story like that this week?
So you think that the pulling out of the Paris Accord and climate change, Donald Trump making the decision on yesterday, right, at the Rose Garden.
Yeah, although it seems like several days ago.
Romano, this is a story that I'm surprised that everybody's surprised, because during the campaign, it felt like this was one of his continuing talking points. I think he brought it up in the debate that he didn't want to be involved. And he's been talking about less global, more America first. But this week, it seemed like everybody came out like, what?
Yeah, I think the fact that he actually did it was probably like shocking to people. And I think the actual like commentary that he made at the news conferences, where he said, you know, I'm indebted to the people of Pittsburgh rather than the people of Paris.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's been a lot of jokes about like, I guess, Earth last, America first. So I think it was just kind of just him listening to him talk about it was what shocked, I think, a lot of people. Not that anything's shocking anymore.
He's done this again and again with big announcements, you know, reality TV show. I'm going to make my big announcement. He's done it. He's said he's going to, and he allows the suspense to build up around him. And then he makes the decision that everyone at the beginning expected him to make.
Okay. So this we've been talking about on the show. We had Michael Hawthorne on the other night talking about this. And the idea that this is a non-binding, it's not a treaty, it's an accord. There was a lot of talk about this being socialism from the right, or this being a treaty that Obama kind of went around to Senate and went around the way that the Constitution's set up. So good on Trump to take away. But this was really an effort to bring the developing world to the table to say we really have to do something about climate change. And it seemed like there was no sort of right or wrong, that everybody was in agreement. So, I mean, am I missing the story here that there's something nefarious about everybody coming together and trying to take on something like climate change?
I guess, you know, his whole thing was this hurts the United States. That was his big thing. And, you know, he seemed to be talking more in terms of like isolationist America and, you know, talking about the mining industry. So I think he made it seem like it's something jobs, whereas it's actually about how the Earth's temperature is rising and all these countries have agreed that let's reduce our greenhouse gases, like our uses of that. But I think they just don't want to. I think his administration doesn't want to focus on solar, wind, and natural gas, energies.
Those were big, big items. How much of this was erasing the legacy of his predecessor?
Maybe. That's one I can't answer. But I've been accused in the past of being overly optimistic under circumstances like this and others. But, I haven't ruled out in my own mind the possibility that out of this could actually come some good. We've already seen in the days, in the hours since the president made his big announcement, a number of states stepping forward, California, mm-hmm. New York, Washington, another state just joined, and now I can't remember which one it was.
Sure.
Saying that they are going to adopt the protocols on their own. Mm-hmm. And I'm reminded of a line, I think it was Samantha Bee who said in another context several months ago, states' rights, it's not just for racists anymore. So out of this could come a new level of responsible behavior, a new level of authority taken by the states, taken by municipalities. Oh. Mayor Emanuel this week said Chicago is going to continue with commitment.
And, you know, it's consistent.
And it might filter down to the individual level, which is, all right, the government isn't going to save us. And this is, of course, the libertarian mindset and to some extent the conservative Republican mindset. The government isn't going to save us. We're all on an individual basis going to have to do things like, you know, buy non-polluting vehicles and we'll
let the market
see.
Determine where we go. And there's something to be said about that, at least in terms of consistency, because we saw with the federal budget proposal, a lot of when we talk about cutting social service agencies and other agencies, the what the budget director in the office is saying is, no, this is for the states to decide. If you want to fund certain social service agencies, do it at the state level. The government, the federal government's going to get out of it. So at least that's consistent to what we're seeing.
Yeah, and I do think it's, you know, making people a little more aware. I mean, it's definitely people making people more activists in, you know, different fields and making people aware of things. I think Rahm Emanuel, just a couple of weeks ago, whatever was taken down on the EPA website, he put back up on, you know, the city website. So I think there's a lot of people, you know, watching very carefully, and which is good. It's making people more
Now, on today's Chicago Public Square, and I read it.
You read it?
I do. And you had a great link, and this is important, I think, for the history to understand politics. This is, as much as everybody wants to make it seem that Donald Trump is out on his own and he's isolated, and all of his administration and all of his people say, oh, what are you doing? This is almost carbon copy of what George W. Bush did in 2001, where he said, we're not going to be in Kyoto. Like, they pulled out of what Clinton and Al Gore had set up a couple of years before. So this isn't new territory necessarily when it comes to Republicans and climate change, global climate change.
Thank you for reading and for signing up at ChicagoPublicSquare.com. I really appreciate it.
But I mean, there's something to that. Yeah. Right.
Well, and again, it would be nice, I think, in my personal opinion, if President Trump had decided to continue the nation's commitment. But in the end, you know, this is more going to be about what corporations decide to do, what consumers decide to do. And we've already seen some companies, Apple Computer, for instance. And of course, Elon Musk said he's making a break with the president on behalf of his companies. The marketplace may bring some pressure to bear for companies to say, we are green, you know, we are Paris Accord compliant, and that becomes a selling point for some people.
Is there any concern, and you hear this a lot in the criticism of the move, the political move this week, that this gives wiggle room or an entryway for countries like China or India or others to take a leadership role and to essentially put pressure, economic pressure, do the exact opposite of what Trump is talking about, where they go, you know what, we're going to invest in solar, we're going to do this, and nobody wants your coal anymore, and we actually lose as a country.
I think so for sure. I mean, what countries aren't part of this agreement? I think it's Syria, Nicaragua, and the United States. And, you know, you look at countries like India, they have been using solar power and they have been doing all these different things. So I think, you know, there's a lot of smart people in India and there's a lot of scientists in India. So they probably are looking at things and, you know, it definitely will change.
And
I mean,
and
you
China
know,
too, right?
And a lot of those students in those countries are definitely better in science and math. So
China,
I mean,
just in the last,
and they're not
years,
coming to the United States because we've told them we don't want them.
Yes,
here.
There have been stories about how in India people used to see this as a place to come, and now people don't want to come.
And
anymore.
We've seen it: tourism and immigration to Illinois is substantially down in the months since President Trump came to power. So the thing that that I think is interesting is something that I was thinking, and now I can't think of it. So this is your cue to jump in. Don't you have a commercial or something to go to?
Charlie Myers and Rumana Hussein in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do overreported and underreported stories. You can jump in if you'd like. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Charlie Meyerson, and Rumana Hussein in studio tonight. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can text, you can call in as we're reloading this week's news. What were the biggest stories? Overreported, underreported, winners, losers. Which story sucked you down the rabbit hole this week, and which story will we remember in 500 years? All right, so let's get to the overreported and underreported, and then we'll get to winners and losers. Overreported, I'll start, if I can start. I truly believe...
Show! It's your show!
I truly believe the Kathy Griffin stuff is overreported. I agree. I believe that she got the correct amount of punishment for doing it, essentially what turns into a joke that was in bad taste and form. But the idea that we let these comedians, and these comedians, but we let them sort of somehow become the spokespeople for political movements. And Kathy Griffin somehow represents the left, or on the right, it was Ted Nugent, you know, with Barack Obama. But they're looking for attention. They know how to, you know, work the system, and we give it to them. And I just feel at a certain point, and even today with the press conference, although kind of interesting when it comes to precedent and what it means to tweet and take away someone's financial opportunity. But you know, I just felt at the end of the day that story was it's just overreported.
Well, one of my friends on Facebook, when I shared an article about that, said, "Who's Kathy Griffin?" I mean, she is, you know,
which is
a reminder. She is from Oak Park, and right? I know that. But it's a reminder to a lot of people. I mean, if you don't watch certain cable channels at certain times, and a lot of people don't, she's now more famous than she was.
Right. I do wonder, though. And the one thing I will take away from that overreported story is today, her point being that if the president tweets at you, and is it bullying? Is it does she lose economic opportunity because she's had shows canceled? She gets fired from CNN. It's different when you're in a argument with a celebrity on Twitter. You can have that argument. You kind of Donald Trump and Rosie O'Donnell come to mind. But when Donald Trump is the president and he continues that argument, does he own too much weight in a Twitter battle that could actually harm somebody's career?
With this president, not.
Yeah.
I mean, this president's tweets have so little currency.
Do you
think she got fired because he tweeted? No, I think this is.
I think it was a backlash because there were people on the left and there were people on the right. And, you know, a lot of people are saying that if you're offended by this, and then they're showing all these pictures of, you know effigies that people had of Obama with the noose around his neck, they're like, well, why wouldn't you be offended by that? And, you know, people are saying, well, that would be criticized as well. But I guess, like, when you look at people like Ted Nugent, like, he's not really on a TV show, so what are you going to cancel about him?
But he said
offensive things.
But I mean, that's the thing.
I
just wonder if it's a different Obama.
Obama's never going to be in a Twitter battle.
Right, that's what I mean.
It's
apples to apples in the way that you're like, if Obama came out and said, "I can't believe you, Ted Nugent. You're a disgrace. You should be ashamed of yourself. My family is upset with what you posted on Facebook."
I don't think that Trump's tweet in this context was the deciding factor. As Stephen Colbert said, when Trump finally came out and acknowledged Colbert's criticism and condemned him, Colbert said, "I win. You acknowledged my existence. I'm a winner."
Right, right.
So it's almost a badge of honor at this point for the president to condemn you on Twitter. I think in this case, if I were CNN, and I don't know what CNN's rationale was in its entirety. But, you know, there's really no upside for them in having her continue to do a New Year's Eve show. And I suspect that decision might have come down even if the president hadn't tweeted his outrage.
It is interesting. I mean, it's for as much that is made of how sensitive our country has become. And this was a big rallying point and a big moment in the campaign. Trump talked about it. His followers talked. They've come up with nicknames for the left, snowflakes and other things like that.
I like snowflakes.
Yeah. but the idea that when there is somebody who does something, it's a little bit closer to the line in this PC culture, which was really rallied against in the Trump campaign. They are hurt. I mean, I think of this SNL writer who made the joke about Trump's son. I think about this thing that there is this strange paradoxical, I would say even hypocritical reaction to when a comedian says something that's too close to bashing Trump, that then the way that his followers sort of react to it.
Yeah, I think there's more of a climate where people get fired left and right. I mean, I think when Bill Clinton was running, wasn't there an SNL skit where Chelsea Clinton was depicted like a little pig? And I don't think there was any fallout. I mean, there was no Twitter at the time. There was no social media.
Right.
You know, now it's like when something is out there, everybody can just go on Twitter and start talking about it. A hashtag can be created. And, you know, shows have been canceled because of this. So, you know, you can definitely start a campaign on Twitter, which you couldn't do 20, 30 years ago.
Michelle Obama's advice seems more apt than ever. You know, when they go low, we go high. And I think in this environment, those who want to win over hearts and minds in their criticism of President Trump are going to have to be on their game and go high.
All right, Charlie, what do you got for overreported?
Tiger Woods arrest.
Yeah.
I thought, and I think this is true in general of mugshots, but as I considered whether to include that mugshot in Chicago Public Square, I decided not. It was just it's just a cheap shot. Anytime somebody's arrested and not charged, or arrested and not convicted, to run those mugshots, those are people, as people smarter than I have said, who are at the low point of their existence, and to blast that photo out, I think is unfair to him. And as much as, you know, Schadenfreude, a word that I know is near and dear to your heart, is something that appeals to all of us when we see someone high and mighty like Tiger Woods brought low, it just, the photo itself seemed unfairly publicized, especially as the story has emerged that it apparently wasn't, you know, alcohol. It's
prescription drugs.
It was prescription drugs, which, you know, for the, you know, but
it's
for
driving
the luck
while
of
impaired,
the
but
gods,
yeah,
we might all wind up. Yeah.
But the argument can be made, I guess, is if it's like a regular average Joe and they're arrested for something, their mugshot gets pasted. And I guess
I don't think that should be happening either until someone's convicted. And then ideally, even
what about
then,
somebody like Jason Van Dyke?
I don't think you run a mugshot of him. I mean, you get a photo of him. Again, hasn't
courts,
been convicted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
And for everyone, we should explain Jason Van Dyke is the cop charged
with shooting Laquan McDonald. And I think in his case, I don't even think, you know, cops are always hesitant to putting out mugshots of police officers who do get arrested. But I think it did take some time, but we did get it and we did use it. So I think that's interesting that you said that, but I think Tiger Woods might have made some joke while his mugshot was being taken. I think they asked him what color his hair was and he said brown, but, you know, sparse, or like I'm losing it or something. That's what somebody said.
If he was impaired at the time, it just doesn't seem fair to take a picture.
It's absolutely true, though. It colored that story in the way that I remember. I went to Google News the day that it came out, and it was the thing that shot up, and that mugshot was in my face, and I was like, oh, what happened with Tiger Woods?
That's
the
same thing I thought, too.
And it was the whole thing, and then you're right. As it went out a little bit, you're like, not that it was great that he's behind the wheel. He shouldn't be when he's impaired, but it's not as nefarious as the headlines in the mugshot led us to believe at the beginning. What do you got, Romana, for overreported?
Well, when I said overreported, I think it's overshared on social media. I think it's the new Nutella cafe that's open. I love Nutella, actually. I had an argument with somebody in the newsroom a couple days ago about how Nutella is better than peanut butter. Me and another reporter thought Nutella was better. And then the same day they announced it was going to be a Nutella cafe.
Right.
It's just that everybody's talking about it, and it's definitely interesting, and the lines are long. I've just seen way too much about it, and I've read way too much about it.
It's right here on Michigan Avenue, and it feels like on my social media feeds, every fourth picture is a picture of a line outside of the store.
Yes, that's what I'm seeing, too. I mean, I think I am curious about it, but I don't think it's going to be months before I actually walk in there. I'll just get some Nutella from the grocery store.
With an electronics store, chocolate store.
Donuts.
A donut store.
Free
but
donut
the idea
day.
That
yes,
free donut
yeah,
day.
But the idea that there's so much hubbub over a store with a line, it is, in my mind, I agree, it's overreported.
And I've never had Nutella. I don't think I've ever had it.
That's good for our Never Have I Ever. We do that Thursday nights, Charlie.
Okay,
Charlie Myers.
I'd rather come on a Thursday than a Friday, by the way. I was hoping someday you'd wrap up the week on a Thursday.
You're a Friday guy for us. Okay. Charlie Myers and Romana Hussein in studio. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do underreported and get to the winners and losers. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Romana Hussein. She is an assistant metro editor at Chicago Sun-Times. Charlie Meyerson, the editor and what would you call it, proprietor?
Proprietor.
Proprietor.
I like that,
proprietor. Chicago Public Square, which you can sign up for, the daily newsletter and website at chicagopublicsquare.com.
Exactly right. Thank you. Checks in the mail.
That's a title.
That's right.
It wasn't an endorsement. It was a title.
But you endorsed it earlier.
I just said I read it.
Well, that's close enough. I'll take that.
All right. All right, 312-981-7200. We are reloading this week's news. We are to the underreported stories. Let's get into underreported. Why don't we start? Mike is on the line, and I want to bring Mike in because Mike shares one of the stories that we were just talking about in the break. Mike, what's your story for? You have it for actual loser, but let's talk about the story.
I'm basically calling it about the killing that happened in Oregon with the white supremacist that killed the two guys that basically stood up for the two Muslim women. And I guess it was, to me, it was a loser, not so much how it was underreported or anything. It was just how many, not necessarily you, Justin, but just many outlets that I was listening to were essentially quick to blame or assign blame to the president and his tone. And that was the cause, or that led to this man, you know, going off on tirade ultimately to
the analysis. I see what you think, Mike. The analysis of that going to the president. I mean, at a certain point, you have to be able to be accountable for your own actions. Mm-hmm. And there has been a lot of talk about how the president's rhetoric and tone has sort of fanned the flames of hate and racism. But Mike might have a point there in the idea that I'm not sure that President Trump has anything to do with this one.
Well, this is definitely a story. I mean, as a Muslim American, it's something that a lot of my friends have been talking about because, you know, these stories do touch us. And, you know, we do notice that I think there was a Muslim guy that was trying to, like, do something in Paris, France, and then he got shot down. And, you know, Trump tweeted about it. But, you know, he's always slow to tweet about white guys who are attacking minorities.
That's
so I think a lot of people do bring that up. But yeah, everybody's responsible. I mean, there is this, you know, debate about whether, you know, Trump is emboldening certain people to go against, you know, minorities or religious minorities or ethnic, you know, minorities or people of color. But I think it was a story. A lot of people that I know, being a Muslim and being from that community, is something, a story that people are really paying attention to. And, you know, the two victims, I think there's an update to the story because I think one of the men that was killed, I think while he was there lying, I think somebody stole his wedding ring and his backpack.
Yeah,
so, I mean, the story is continuing. Yeah, the guy was in court this week and, you know, obviously the commentary he made. So it's definitely people are responsible, but, you know, of course, the rhetoric is out there, too.
I would say the president is not blameless in this. And given that there are people in this society who are already and always will be on the edge, unpredictable in their behavior, easily influenced in their behavior, they get signals, whether they have foil on their heads or not.
You're right.
And no, I don't believe that one can, you know, indict the president for this particular case. But I do think that his campaign and his presidency have created an environment where people who are living on the knife's edge are going to fall off very easily.
I would make a correlation to his predecessor as well, because the right has always spoken up about how President Obama has, especially when it comes to law enforcement, has made the police the aggressor and the communities the spoke for communities, not police officers, and he's emboldened the Black Lives Matter movement. And we've heard that. I'm saying that's what's been heard from the right, the idea that, you know, the president sends these signals. So it's the same concept of, you know, is this president sending signals?
Well, with this, it's like, you know, there are specific groups that have been targeted by this administration. You know, look at something like the Muslim ban, what people call, you know, the travel ban. It is targeting a certain group of people. And, you know, the rhetoric is targeted towards a certain group of people. So when you have the president of the United States saying certain things about certain groups, yeah, he's not responsible for the actions of every single person. But this is the leader of your country saying things that aren't really necessarily positive about a certain group. So I think in a way it does make people realize, like, hey, it's okay to do this. And I think hate crimes have increased against certain groups. You know, we had the, you know, even against Jewish groups and different other groups, not just Muslims.
That, Well, Ruman, let's go to your underreported story, because I agree with you entirely. You know, when it comes to some of the issues that if they happened in more westernized countries, and we talk about terrorist attacks, or bombings, things like that, we get candlelight vigils and tribute concerts. And if it happens in America, you know, forever coverage. Bombing in Kabul this week didn't get much, if just sort of like blip in the news.
And for me, that was one of the most underreported stories. And when I say underreported, we do have reporters actually covering the story.
Just the way it's been covered. Accepted. Yeah,
but like, is it front page news for us? No. Whereas if something happened in France or England, it's on front page. People's Facebook filters change. And, you know, that I'm just saying as a person of color and as someone who has ties to, you know, places that aren't necessarily in Europe, it's interesting how people react to different, you know, whether the victims were non-Muslim or if they're white, as opposed to whether they're Muslim. And people think this is like, oh, this happens all the time in these countries. And that's not necessarily true. I think there was an attack in Brussels, I think about a year and a half ago, and it made the front page news. And I thought it was interesting because maybe 2 years ago, there was an attack in a school in Pakistan. And I think there was a large number of kids that were killed, and it was not a front page story. I can guarantee you there's more Pakistani Americans in Chicago than there are people from Brussels.
It always blows my mind. And I would say that that story specifically, the bombing in Kabul, was a very it was a stylized kind of bombing.
Oh yeah, I mean, it was somebody in a water delivery truck.
Yeah,
I think
it was a very strange way that they did it, and very scary.
And it was by embassies too, right. So it was supposed to be in a safe zone. So it's definitely, you know, and I know people think Afghanistan, which is how I pronounce it, but Afghanistan, people think it's, you know, oh, it's always been in war, it's always been turmoil, but, you know, there's victims there too. And that's what I always find interesting. Whenever there's a terrorist attack, people always think that, oh, it's the West getting attacked. But I'm like, you know, Muslims are probably the number one victims of terrorist attacks. And I just wish that more people were paying attention to it. So I don't think it was an underreported story. I think it's a story that people weren't paying attention to as much as I think they should have.
Charlie, what do you got for underreported?
Well, the clock is ticking on this deal under which the Chicago Tribune's parent company, Trunk, can acquire the Chicago Sun-Times, where Romana works, and the Chicago Reader, and maybe, is there other properties involved? I think those are the two big ones.
Yeah.
They extended the deadline.
They've extended the deadline.
Yes, because they said for interested buyers.
And we're kind of at a disadvantage in that the two organizations that are at the center of this story are the two organizations that more often than not, those of us who aren't in those organizations would count on to be digging into this story and tell us what's going on. Who are the players? Who's making the bids?
Right.
And I haven't seen a lot about, you know, what these movements are. Who are the players who have expressed interest?
We saw a couple stories. We saw Natasha Kurecki had a story this week in Politico about who there was sort of anonymous bidders that were coming up.
Exactly.
Two or three bidders that weren't Trunk. Robert Feeders had a lot saying that the Sun-Times staff and editorial staff was worried about there being a monopoly in town and was pushing against
this. With good reason.
Sure. But there was definitely, but you're absolutely right. The idea that the two major papers, the major news organizations, because of conflict of interest and have had to recuse themselves essentially, and we don't get the news.
I don't know that they've had to, because, you know, I worked for the Chicago Tribune at the time when it was sold to Sam Zell, and there was, back then, what I would call fearless reporting on what was going on. They had a firewall up between the reporting on the purchase and the editors who were actually the executives of the company who were involved in the negotiations. And I just haven't seen any of that this time. The sort of where are the reporters who are digging in on this story, who have been given independence by their corporate overlords to dig in on the story? Who are the players? Who's interested in buying? Who's slowing it down? What are the prospects? There really have only been, you know, a couple of inflection points on this story and nothing in between.
I mean, we just had a story, I think, when it was announced. We had one reporter covering it. But, I mean, I can tell you from the Sun-Times point of view, it's like we don't have any reporters left to do the digging, you know? So it's like we're just trying to do the everyday story. So when we hear about something like this, we've had a pretty rough last couple of years, you know, starting in 2008 with the layoffs. And I think, you know, the mood at the paper is like, you know, we're just going to work hard. You know, we definitely asked questions about this, you know, when it was announced, when Jim Kirk announced this, and, you know, we listened and we probably know as much as anybody else knows. And we just figure we just keep going. But yeah, there is that fear. Like, will this eventually be just a one paper town?
I'm here to cheer you on and say, put a reporter on this and do some digging and be the ones to tell us who's involved.
you know, Scott Smith was on earlier. We were talking local media this week, and the price in which the Chicago Sun-Times was staying somewhere at $5 million, $3 million, whatever it is. I mean, it's such a far cry from what it was. But does that open the door? And I'll ask Charlie this, as Romano can recuse herself. But does that open the door for a philanthropist, for a tech startup, for someone to go, $5 million, that's nothing?
Yeah, it does. It's not a done deal. Michael Farrow, who heads Tronc, the Tribune, the Chicago Tribune's parent company. I mean, that's him. We got lots of other rich people in Chicago. I look at what Jeff Bezos has done. You know, the Amazon mogul who purchased the Washington Post. He has done some amazing things, or allowed his staff to do some amazing things. Because from what I understand, he's taken a hands-off approach. The Washington Post has become, for me at least, my go-to source for reporting on the Trump campaign, even more so than the New York Times, partly because the firewall is a little more porous and they're focused on gaining an internet audience. Someone with pocket change, really, for these gazillionaires could come in and duplicate what he has done, and there's great potential to serve the Chicago market and make money.
Charlie Meyerson, Romano Hussein in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We're going to do winners and losers. Sound good? Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. You can text or you can call in. All right, let's get to winners and losers. Winners are, I mean, winners, we never want to talk about the winners. We just want to talk about the losers.
Yeah, I like talking Charlie about winners.
Romano Hussein in studio. Who you got for winners, Charlie?
Al Franken.
Why
Al Franken? Has been unleashed. You know, as I imagine many people know, he's a Saturday Night Live veteran who's now a senator from Minnesota and has been for many years. And a lot of people have been waiting for him to be funny in Congress, his fans anyway. But he's got a new book out called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate, in which he kind of lets loose in ways that he hasn't.
He's going to be at LitFest next week for Printer's Row.
Well, you know, I'm a fan of his comedic work, and I think as a senator, he's been fascinating to watch. And now that this book is out, basically it's, and I haven't read the book yet, but it's a compilation of all the jokes that he wishes he could have said, but didn't. For instance, you know, inclined to be funny, this is an anecdote I read. When he first came to the Senate, he was pushing through a group of tourists and said, "Excuse me, more important than you. Excuse me, more important than you." and he realized, you know, after someone called him out for it, that, you know, that might be funny if you weren't a senator, but when you are a senator, that kind of stuff just doesn't
work.
And yet now he seems to be trying some of this material out.
Yeah, senators don't have a great track record for making fun of themselves.
And of course, the question is this an indication that he might consider running for president? He's, of course, as all candidates would do, saying no.
Well, you know, it's funny because I would have said, "Oh, no way, can you have an entertainer?"
Point, yeah.
But then I'm like, "Well, what are we talking about?"
Trump has blown away all the barriers to decorum that we would normally expect.
It'd be fun, I guess. Only if he did his. Remember, he was the. He played Paul Simon, Senator Paul Simon from Illinois, in all of the sketches in the 80s.
Oh, he did.
For Saturday Night Live. Well,
I just remember him at the Stuart Smiley. Was it
Smalley? Yeah.
Smartly, yeah. I just remember that one.
Stuart Smalley, yeah. Yeah. And one of the bits that he did that I use in my journalism classes is the thing he did where he was a one-man band reporter at a time when it was impractical. He had a big satellite dish on his head and very heavy equipment. Yeah. And, of course, now you can do it all with your smartphone.
Yeah, he was ahead of the time. All right, Romano, let's go right to losers. I mean, we had other winners too, and we'll get to those in other parts of the reload. But we got to talk Springfield. I mean, this was the big story. It came very close in my mind to being the biggest story of the week, beat out by the Paris Accord. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I ask you both. I mean, who wins? Who loses? I mean, politically. I mean, last week it was, you know, who loses? The taxpayers. All right.
Yeah.
Well, let's put that to the side. Who won? Did the Democrats win or did the Republicans win by not getting enough for the 700 plus days of no budget?
You know, from the continuous times I've been reading, we had at the Sun-Times, we had 702 days without a budget and we finally stopped. We had a countdown and I don't know if you noticed on the paper. So it was 702 yesterday and we stopped today because, you know, the session is over. But I guess in this instance, if you're just going to look at it, it's Bruce Rauner, right? Winning, you know, getting, you know, it's kind of like you're hearing this over and over again. I feel like it's a broken record. Like, I know it's the biggest story of the week, but as someone who, you know, deals with the news every day and someone who consumes the news,
it doesn't change
much. I feel like the stories I read feel like a broken record, but I think Bruce Rauner probably is the winner in this instance.
Well, Bruce Rauner definitely making the rounds today. I mean, he was on Cochrane this morning. He's out and about, and he's, you know, talking about how what a disaster, what tragedy, failure of the Democrats. I don't hear too many Democrats. I mean, State Senate President John Cullerton was on as well, I heard. But, I mean, he seems to be wanting to talk about this mess where you don't hear much from Mike Madigan.
Well, that's Michael Madigan's modus operandi, which is not to talk. So that's, I don't know if that means that he's a winner or loser in this context. But I'd agree with Ramana that, you know, I think given all the factors that were in play, this seems to be the outcome that Governor Rauner wanted. He could have had a budget. He could have compromised. He has, as indicated, no willingness to compromise. It's his way or no way. And he wound up, and the Tribune, I believe, had an in-depth article this morning or yesterday about how he manipulated things so that he would not be sent a budget. Because he's not doesn't on the record, want right? a budget, not on the record, is vetoing.
Let me ask you this, though. I mean, politically, and this is a war. This is not a battle.
Oh, yeah.
And these two parties have gone at each other in each step, trying to force the other one to get on the record to do something different, to do something that they can use. I mean, you saw right away. I mean, it was I think Rich Miller was saying, you know, 6 hours after the fact, they were robocalls about the Democrats want a tax hike and they didn't get another budget done. But the point, I guess, at the end of the day, is it is a war, and we focusing on the battle of another budget that didn't happen. But, I mean, there's still a long way to go to, I guess, what's the end? I don't know what the end goal game is.
Yeah, I don't know.
And
I think taxpayers are getting frustrated, too. I think we had a story in the paper. Tina Svandelis, our political reporter, had a story about how, you know, people are going on these, like, lawmakers' Facebook pages and just, you know, getting so angry at the, you know, these lawmakers for not coming up with the budget and just saying how, like, you know, they're frustrated and, you know, they're taking and lashing out at them. So it's getting interesting. I think people are just fed up in general.
The one thing you wonder.
Tired of listening.
Political strategy. I mean, it's pretty great. I will say, for as bad lawmakers they are, down in Springfield, they're pretty brilliant politicians in the way that they are both making moves to make the other one look bad. But at the end of the day, if the goal is the governor's mansion, Mike Madigan and company can run on the fact in 2018 that the governor accomplished nothing. There was not one budget in the 4 years. He was not able to lead the state to a balanced budget, to any of the structural reforms that he wanted. He did nothing. Now, will the taxpayers believe that?
Your guess is as good as mine. Yeah. I, you know, after this last election in particular, I make no predictions at all. I avoid making predictions at all costs. We shall see. Only time will tell.
I'll say on the other side, too, because I don't want to sound biased, but I'm like, and Democrats, too, because we just said the Democrats didn't put a budget forward. They are on the hook. And not only that, Bruce Rauner and the Republicans forced them to show their hand, which was a massive income tax hike. So now you've set up what each party's weakness is as we get ready for a 2018 election among billionaires.
I think that a massive income tax increase, and it's your word, not mine, massive there, is something that might not prove as unpopular as some people think. That if one can make a case that taxes are being increased for those who can most afford to pay it, that the income tax is the most equitable way to improve Illinois' situation. And I think there is a lot of, I suspect, there's a lot of voter support to be found for someone who can advance a plan, and it's been tried and tried again. Don Clark Netsch, decades ago, tried it and was shot down. But the idea that the income tax, unlike the property tax, which continually rises whether your income rises or not, that an income tax which fluctuates with your ability to pay on a year-to-year basis is the most fair, most equitable way to fund state government.
Right, you pay more if you make more.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know why there's such objection to that, or why people would think
I think people
be such
just hear taxes and your taxes being raised. They don't necessarily think, you know, the calculations into it. So I think just people hear that and they automatically say no, shut it down. But I don't know. It'd be interesting. Like you said, you never know what people would be interested in. So just to get a balanced budget.
I just think it's great politics. It's terrible for the taxpayers of Illinois. But it is great politics to watch both of these leaders in the party try to put the other one in a box.
And meanwhile, people are dying. Children in particular are dying. I think, again, this is another aspect of the state's budget problem is the Department of Children and Family Services. Yeah. It's continuing problems. The resignation of its leader this week.
And we're running out of time because we're coming up on the news. But that story, we haven't even had a chance to talk about. That one, I want to go down the rabbit hole because didn't taxpayers and Republicans nail Pat Quinn's wall back to the wall on the DCFS and the troubles they were having when he was governor? And here we are, not even 4 years later with Republican leadership and DCFS and the same problems exist. This is interesting that it seemed like there was much more Democrats are really ruining DCFS 4 years ago, and now it seems to... I mean, this is like the fourth or fifth leader in 18 months or something?
And, you know, the problems that the state social workers are asked to deal with are horrific, and that's one that I think is suffering, that problem, that front is suffering because the state doesn't have the money to put into it.
Ramana Hussein, Charlie Meyerson in studio. We are breaking down this week's news or reloading this week's news. 312-981-7200. We'll come back. We'll talk about which stories sucked us down the rabbit hole and which stories will be remembered 5, 10, 50, 500 years from this week. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. It's a download, 720 WGN, Justin Kaufman. Ramana Hussein, the assistant metro editor at Chicago Sun-Times. Charlie Meyerson of Chicago Public Square. In studio, we're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Before we get to the rabbit hole story and which story will be remembered from this week, let's go to the text line. 815 says, I'm not interested in higher taxes. Absolutely ludicrous. When the morons in Springfield can control their spending, no new taxes. You can't keep coming after the taxpayers for your stupidity.
Not even the rich taxpayers?
And, you know, Eric Zorn had a piece this week that I thought was really, really enlightening.
I was going to mention this.
The idea that Illinois, the state of Illinois, spending, and the governor likes to mention this, that spending's out of whack, the high-spending Democrats in Illinois, it is in line and below the United States average when it comes to spending and how big the government is in Illinois.
And to our listener who just texted, I wonder if this person would be against higher income taxes if it were accompanied by lower property taxes.
That's 773, no more taxes. I think that you might have hit on something, Ramana, when you're like the word tax.
Yeah.
Because you're right. If you pay more, you should pay more taxes. That's
makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But I'm not an elected official.
815 says the Senate did pass a budget with revenue to the House. I know, but the budget did not get out of the House. That's what we're saying. So there's a couple more things in here just about their companies are offering insurance in case of Trump attacks or other social media fiascos now. It's interesting.
I should look into that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. All right. Okay, so, you know, let's get to the rabbit hole story. This is the story that you took a little bit more time. You got into. You spent more time reading and understanding the story than just sort of regurgitating
I'm not sure
the
that's
headlines.
Possible yeah, in right. the case of the story I'm thinking.
Ramana,
of.
Your story is one that I saw the headlines on, and I didn't go any further. Mm-hmm. But it has a little hometown feel for you.
Yeah, this is the attack of the Uber driver that happened Tuesday morning, and the young person that got charged with the crime was a 16-year-old girl. And it was an interesting case because it happened in Lincolnwood, and that's only a couple blocks. The incident actually happened only a couple blocks away from where I grew up. So I thought it was a pretty interesting story just because so many people are driving Uber or taking people around just for extra money. And you never think you're going to, you hear cases where the Uber driver is the one attacking someone,
right,
but you
right.
have heard very little stories about.
Because at the end of the day, you're tracked and it's you're on the phone and there's a little bit of security in the fact that it's not an anonymous crime.
Yeah, and this definitely was one of those cases where it was random because this young woman, according to prosecutors, had gotten to three Uber drivers that day. This was a third victim within a couple hours, early Tuesday morning. She first had an Uber driver take her to a train station, I think, in Des Plaines. Then she went to a Walmart not
too
far.
Did she attack on the first one? No.
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 And then she ordered another Uber driver to take her to a Walmart not too far from the crime scene. And then she actually shoplifted a knife and a machete. And nobody stopped her. She was caught on camera, but she just walked out of a Walmart, unwrapped the weapons, and this young man from Wilmette ended up picking her up And within 2 minutes, prosecutors said that he was attacked and he ended up dying. And she was found by police officers in Lincolnwood nearby because she tried to take the car and the car ended up crashing into a median. And then she was hiding in the corner. So, you know, I'm sure there's people thinking.
I mean, we're way ways from trials and things like that. But is there motivation for this or is this random and senseless?
Said, you know, they said she didn't talk to police officers. But the judge during the bond hearing, because I did edit the story, at least for the Sun-Times, he said that, you know, this was a random act. And it was just a very tragic story because there was this young man. I think he, you know, did some acting and worked in the restaurant business and had a lot of friends and just was trying to make an extra living. And
you know, you get desensitized to Uber or taxi stories and altercations between the passengers and the drivers because it happens so much and frequently. And like you said, usually the other way around. But as a consumer, I always will see that story and put it into the crime blotter and move on. But you're right, once you get deeper into it, it's crazy to think like that.
The older I get, the more I'm inclined to tip drivers more generously. Mm-hmm. It's an often thankless task and is a dangerous one. This an extreme case, but it's you know you're meeting strangers all the time and you're getting into an enclosed space with them where they could do anything.
Yeah. Charlie, what do you got for the rabbit hole story of the week?
Covfefe, which is how I pronounce it. And if you pronounce it some other way, you're wrong.
I called it coffee-fee.
President Trump's, I really don't know how it's pronounced. I'm not sure.
Some people say it's Arabic.
It was fascinating. And for those who don't know, I guess we should explain. It apparently was the president's tweeted typo for the word coverage.
Spicer said it wasn't a typo, or he said it wasn't.
When's the last time Sean Spicer said something that was true?
Another weird story this week.
But the aspects of the story were many and varied, including the fact it's now been added, apparently, I haven't had a chance to test it yet, to the Words with Friends dictionary, so you can use that. That would be a lot of points, because V is 5 points, I think. Yes. F is 4 points. That would be, and if you have a triple letter score in there, or a triple word, could be a real bonanza of a word.
It happened that night, and we were on the air when it happened, and Pete and I, right after the show, we were sitting at our desk, and you know, I had TweetDeck up on my computer, and I remember saying it to him, like, I've never seen my feed be one topic and every tweet coming in, because it's varied, it's all over, and it'll be a lot of different things, but this just captured social media so quickly and like wildfire that it was the hottest and overreported and underreported and crazy and winner and loser all in one for about 12 hours.
And then it sat. We have yet to get an explanation of why it sat there for 6 hours or so before the president or someone deleted it and then the president made a joke about it. What was he thinking?
I think maybe it was Twitter fingers and he just didn't look at it again. I agree.
It was an incomplete sentence, even if you assume it was the word coverage. Well, what about it?
When I initially saw the word, I can tell you, I thought I was stupid because I was like, is this something I'm supposed to know? Or like, what is that word? And I was like, oh my God, I'm like, it's probably some word I have no idea. It's right. Like maybe some sort of agreement or like, you know, in instead of the Paris Agreement, this is something else he came up with. And then I realized it was a Twitter mistake.
How many people have now adopted that as their password? I wonder.
Oh, there've been like videos on how to make confeffi or however it's pronounced, and it's like coffee. But then like somebody goes crazy and like you know there's been a lot of jokes and people are making.
And Hillary Clinton's response, you all saw that.
Right. No, what
people,
did she say?
People who live in confeffi houses shouldn't throw confeffi.
That's awesome.
I have two stories that went down the rabbit hole. Both pretty mainstream stories, but one which I think was tremendous was J.B. Pritzker being on the Blagojevich tapes. Mm-hmm. I thought if there's one thing that you cannot do when you're running as a Democrat in the state of Illinois for governor is to be in the same breath or on tape with Governor Rod Blagojevich. I just feel like at a certain point, like that's become the political notebook. Everyone has tried to stay away from it. You see everybody from even Pat Quinn, who was lieutenant governor. Everyone is moved away from as far as they can, and then the new hope for the Democrats running for governor, voila, a tape surfaces where he is talking to the governor.
Yeah, there's your campaign ad, your opposition ad for 2018.
And I guess what really grabbed my attention was those were That tape, that specific tape, was a tape that was not permissible in the court. Was one that was stricken from the record. It had nothing to do. They had done a lot of lawyering during that time, if you remember. And there were a lot of tapes that were thrown out, and ones that were permissible, and ones that weren't. That wasn't. It leaked to the Tribune. They were able to release it. But in that tape, you hear something that was never heard before, and you do hear a little bit more of Governor Blagojevich in his sort of conniving ways, the ways that have been debated for the last 5 years now about whether or not he got too hard of a sentence. Can you put someone in jail for thinking about doing it? There's all those kind of thoughts, and I thought this showed a side of Governor Blagojevich that was not very flattering, and kind of doubled down on the fact that this guy had one idea, and that was to sell the seats and whatever he can get for it. So I just felt like that was kind of the takeaway from that story, was hearing Rod Blagojevich in the moment from years ago, you know, from almost 10 years ago now. It's crazy.
Pritzker's, you know, definitely a contender for the loser category this week.
Yeah. And the other one, and this is one that I know that people get mad at me at talking about the Russia story. The Putin's interview, which I thought was really interesting, where he was saying that he almost likens it to anti-Semitism,
the
way that the Russians have been beaten up by the Americans in this. And then he talked about that it's not necessarily maybe it's not Russia, but it's, you know, a hacker from Russia. That was the other thing. And then the third was, and this is a very small story that kind of came and went, but was about Attorney General Jeff Sessions and an NBC report that said, again, a source, a leak, someone putting out that they're being investigated for a third possible meeting Attorney General Jeff Sessions had during the campaign. It was in April of 2016, which is on the, people knew about it. That could have been private, and more importantly, was not. He didn't tell people about it. And when you think about what happened, you mentioned Al Franken, the confirmation hearings, where he said he never met with any Russian officials. Then he came back. Oh, I forgot about that one. Then he came back again. Oh, I forgot about that second. Now it's possible to go. Oh, I thought I there's a third. And I already got someone 708 saying, can we just please move on? And I get the concept of that notion. But the question I continue, and Jared Kushner's story in the New York Times this week, is the idea that if this is nothing and we need to move on and it's just a conspiracy on the left because Hillary Clinton lost and everyone's mad, why are they lying and covering it up? And it continues to happen in this way that it can't – these are professional politicians. These are professional lawmakers. They know they cannot be caught saying something that's not true under oath, yet they're doing it. And I'm confused. When you say, can we just move on, I'm confused why the Trump administration won't let us.
That's a story that's going to keep going.
Yeah.
I think it should.
Because I don't necessarily think there's collusion. I'm not sure, you know, as an enlightened consumer, I'm like, oh, yeah, it could be anything. I don't know what's happening, but it's interesting to watch how much cover-up there's been.
This is what some people in the journalism profession refer to as a turn of the screw story. And there are many turns and probably many screws in this story, and it's going to be hard, I think, for journalists and for members of the public to get really excited about any one turn or any one screw until
there's a painted
where's
picture,
the metaphor
right,
go from
right,
here
right.
I'm not sure where
I know
just,
what
everything's
mean,
all screwed up,
so it's an IKEA dresser,
exactly. There you go, thank you. So we all should be incredibly grateful to the reporters who are out there with their screwdrivers. And I'm going to drop the metaphor at this point, doing the hard work that is revealing these things bit by bit, and the prosecutors and the government investigators who are now also working on a parallel path. And at some point, maybe we'll get to the truth, which the administration does not seem inclined to reveal.
Yeah, now there's going to be no more questions on Russia. It's going to go through lawyers. There's not even going to be daily briefings. So, I mean, it gets to a certain point where I guess you can go to Twitter and you could say it's a witch hunt, and you can say that this is just because sour grapes. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, you look at it and you say, but then why are there so many mistruths?
On the daily briefings? they weren't that useful.
All right. Charlie Myers and Ramana Hussein in studio. We'll take a break. We'll come back and we will give our stories of what's going to be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from this week. Stay with us. I should have said that the rabbit hole story is I am in the middle of for Litfest. We're talking about this on the show. I am for fun, there's so many great authors that are coming, and you know they only come to Chicago for one weekend a year. I booked 8 of them.
Wow, who?
I've got Sachi Cool, who's the BuzzFeed.
Yeah, she's all. Yeah.
Samantha Irby, Mark Bowden, who I'm reading his book now. He's the guy who wrote Black Hawk Down, and it's Hue 1968. It's about the Battle of Hue in South Vietnam, right at the Tet Offensive. It's phenomenal. Mm. And that's the rabbit hole, because I've read 250 pages in a day. And this is like, that's all I've been doing. So I feel like if you want to stay, we could stay for like an hour and we can just talk about what the first
one. Do you read all the books?
I try, yeah.
How was the Cole book?
I've only gone 2 essays in, and it's good.
It's good. I've heard about it.
Yeah, it's good. She's got an
Canadian
older boyfriend.
Indian. Yeah.
That's
How much older?
She doesn't say, but she always makes jokes that he's just about to die.
Do you find the interview goes better when you actually have read the whole book? Or do you find that you go down the rabbit hole and it becomes more about you're trying to impress the author that you've read the book as opposed to bringing the audience in?
The problem I have is that if it's a novel and it's something that people haven't read, you just end up talking about things that are particular to what you've read. So you're like, tell me about when Rachel finds the flower. You know, and you're like, what? So that's a harder thing. But this book with the Hue 1968, I won't have that problem. It's a historical document. It's really, really good. And it has a lot of parallels to Afghanistan, to Iraq. It has a lot of parallels to the relationship between the U.S. government and the New York Times and the Washington Post. It's kind of interesting that the U.S. government at the time hates the New York Times and Washington Post, because they are giving contradictory statements on the war and all sorts of stuff. So
it's the natural state of things.
Yeah, it is.
Really,
but I mean,
is.
It makes you think, like, you know, LBJ was talking about the same concept of that these papers were unfair, and it's the same stuff that Donald Trump's talking about today.
Yeah. The more recent period where there was relative peace between government and newspapers is the aberration across American history. Yeah. This is its more natural state.
Really?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, so let's talk about which stories we're going to be remembering from this week, 100, 500 years from now. Charlie?
I got a curve to throw you.
Okay.
I think, you know, 50 years from now, it might be the Paris Accords. We'll see. I don't think 500 years from now, I'm skeptical that any of us will be here if something doesn't happen.
I don't think the Earth
happen.
Will be here, so that's why.
The Earth will
say.
Be here. I'm not sure if there'll be people here.
Maybe not.
But if there are still people here, I actually suspect that the word covfefe will still be in dictionaries
yes.
500 years from now.
So a new word. Wow, that's
good.
I think
that's what we've given birth
Romana,
to.
Romana, what
week.
Do you got for stories?
I originally had said the pulling out of the Paris agreement, but I will also say the Beatles anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's coming
years,
out. It's
right?
50 years, so I think in 500 years people will still
be.
Remember that.
Wait,
it's 500 years.
Yeah. Are we going to remember the 50th anniversary? 500?
No, I guess
man, that 50-year anniversary
you
was a
what?
Great celebration.
I actually do remember the 20th anniversary because I was in high school and we had to learn about it. But
there you go.
So what your real prediction is for 500, 50
I'll remember,
years from
I'll
now.
Remember.
450 years
yeah,
from
maybe
now.
Maybe in 20 years. 20 years, I'll remember talking about it
there you go.
On the radio.
Mine is much more cosmic. The way that NASA announced this week that they are going to be sending a probe to the sun.
The Parker probe.
Named after a UFC physicist, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid that that's going to anger the sun. And in 150, 250 years, we'll be fighting the sun. We'll be a big war with the sun. I think that's what's going to happen. No, but I think something's going to happen with that probe. That we'll
Are you apologizing for your prediction there?
Maybe we'll find out something's wrong with the sun. Maybe we'll find out that, you know what? The sun's not a friend. Like, there's a lot that could happen with a probe to the sun. Maybe it's not as hot as we thought it
what
was.
What I want to know is, have we equipped this probe with lots of sunscreen?
Right.
I hope there's some on board.
I'm fascinated by the story, just with the idea that, I mean, I would assume that it's
the
transmitting.
The pictures are really cool. I don't know if you've seen the pictures. They're awesome.
I know. I wonder what's going to happen. But anyway. Charlie Meyerson, Chicago Public Square. You can sign up for the daily newsletter, which daily email, which goes out daily.
That's right.
And it's also on the reader poll for Best of Chicago. It's Best Newsletter. Is that what it is?
Best news site. Vote for us.
Vote for it.
Never mind those other guys. On that.
Romana Hussein is the assistant metro editor at the Chicago Sun-Times. You guys, thanks so much for joining us
tonight.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you. Thanks, Rob. Coming up, Michael Patrick Thornton's going to be here. Excited to talk to him. He's co-directing a new show at The Gift. Michael Patrick Thornton, one of my first big table guests on the show. It's kind of cool. have him back. Show's Pilgrims. Playwright Claire Kieschel is going to join us as well. She's a big deal. So that'll be fun. I haven't seen this guy. I haven't seen Michael in a while, so it'll be good to have him in studio, and we can talk about what he's been up to. So that's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight. But first, yeah, let's get to our regular segment. Last week, we had the maiden voyage of Reality Check, our segment about reality television and its connections and roots in Chicago. We talked about some of the shows that were set here. We also talked about some of the contestants. And, of course, we talked about The Bachelorette. The Bachelorette has, what was it, four Chicago contestants, although one of them got bounced in the first round. Not very Chicago, or maybe total Chicago. Think about it. Tracy Swartz is one of the columnists for the Inc. column in the Chicago Tribune, and she joins us on the line to update us on the week that Chicago had on reality television. Tracy, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's talk about this. Now, I just want to let you know that Pete Zimmerman has spent, he actually is watching The Bachelorette now. You that was because of you last week. He's now in.
Oh, I'm sure it wasn't because of me.
You were so thorough in your recap of The Bachelorette week one that now Pete's hooked.
I'm not going to take the blame. I'm sure Pete wanted to watch on his own. Using me as an excuse.
That's true. All right, so last week we talked that Chicago had full representation in The Bachelorette. We lost one of the gentlemen in week one. But this week, how did our Chicago guys do?
Pretty well. So we have three Chicago guys left, and two of them each went on a group date with The Bachelorette, Rachel.
Okay.
So this week she had two group dates and a solo date. And they all...
As one does.
Right. It's like a typical week, you know, for you. So she had a group date, which was hosted by Ashton Kutcher, everyone's favorite Bears fan, and his wife, Mila Kunis. And basically, they did this really weird obstacle course called Husband Material. So you had to do all the things that make you a good husband, or so they say, which included like vacuuming, diapering a baby, putting on a baby Bjorn, all sorts of stuff.
Okay.
So there's like eight guys who are in this obstacle course, and including our guy, Iggy, who is a CEO here, and he got out on the first round.
Uh-oh.
He could not diaper a baby. He talked a lot about how he knew he would eventually have to diaper a baby, but he did not expect to be this soon. So he got out on the first round, super embarrassing, and got sent to the doghouse, which was this little area next to the obstacle course, you know, cordoned off for the losers of the challenge.
It's called the doghouse? Is that a real thing?
Yeah, it was a real thing that actually happened. Mm. Yeah, so not husband material.
Did they play a sound effect like wah wah?
No. It was just embarrassing. That was one of the group dates. She went on a solo date to Palm Springs as part of like a dog festival. She has this very adorable dog named Copper who injured his leg, so he was wearing like a little doggy cast. Really, she should just stay with the dog and not marry any of these guys. The dog was the best star on Monday's episode. She went out with Peter, who you may remember is the personal trainer who used to live in Chicago.
Yeah,
was
right.
Named one of Time Out Chicago's hottest trainers of 2012.
Yep.
From Wisconsin. So she went on a one-on-one date with him, and things went really, really well.
Good. I'm pulling for him. He's my guy.
He's your guy? Yeah. So you like the guy who ditched Chicago?
Yeah, I just like the hot personal trainers. That's just my thing. I'm just a hot personal trainer kind of guy.
So they went on a date and it went very well, and he's a guy to keep your eye on. And then they had a group date after that, which was, again, I think it was like eight guys, and they went to a gym and they played basketball, and they were coached by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, of all people.
He's really on the book tour.
he was out there, you know, pitching himself to Bachelor Nation, rolling his eyes at these guys who played horrible basketball, just terrible. And so we had our guy Diggy, who is the Groupon inventory analyst, in that date. He's kind of forgettable though, because the real drama happens with this other guy who's not from Chicago. He's from California. He had this horrible confrontation with his ex-girlfriend. His ex-girlfriend confronts him on this group date and talks to Rachel about how he was still seeing her up until he began filming The Bachelorette.
How did they let that happen? How did the producers let that happen? Oh,
yeah,
I'm being
exactly.
sarcastic.
How did
right?
that happen? Yeah.
How did she get there?
it was very awkward. But I thought Rachel handled herself really well. That's the thing about Rachel. She's pretty no drama, which can kind of make for a boring season when the stars actually handle themselves well and don't like.
do shady things. Right.
Yeah, exactly. So you just have to depend on the guys. And so that guy was the most dramatic piece of the episode. So we have a new episode on Monday.
Okay.
And that'll feature the third Chicago guy, Anthony. He works for like an education software company. He used to play football for Northwestern. And they're going on a big solo date on Monday's episode. And they're going horseback riding. So that'll be exciting for Monday. I hope the horse flips out. I'm hoping that Anthony has more charisma than the horse, but it seems like the animals of The Bachelor are kind of
they're the ones
show.
Winning. Tracy Swartz joins us. She is the ink columnist at the Chicago Tribune. Our Friday night segment, Reality Check. We check in on the reality shows and their connections to Chicago. Of course, the big one is The Bachelorette. I didn't see the show, and I realize now I really kind of want to get into it. You're doing a good job of explaining my Chicago brethren who are competing for Rachel's heart. You know, when you talk about like the ex-girlfriend, because that's always been a thing on these shows, right? The idea of when they tape and this person wasn't actually or they're not. You know, he's got a girlfriend back home or a boyfriend over here. Right. I mean, that you hear that come out after the fact. So I'm surprised that they kind of played that out as part of the plot.
Oh no, they want confrontation, and like I said, Rachel is actually like very level-headed. She is an attorney. She is frankly too good for this franchise, so they need this kind of drama. But what is a different level about The Bachelor and The Bachelorette that I don't know if people know at home is that a lot of the people who end up on the show have already dated other contestants. So it's a very sort of incestuous pool that they are pulling from. Like, you'll find that contestants, like there's one guy on the season who dated a woman who was on Ben Higgins' season. He was the Bachelor, the season 20 Bachelor.
Okay.
But you find a lot of this like cross sort of pollination of this franchise.
Do they do that on purpose for the drama?
Yes. The two of the contestants this on Monday's episode, they had fought over a girl and it came to head. Like, this one guy had lived with this woman who had dated this other contestant. So they already had a backstory coming in here. And as a viewer, you know, you're trying to piece it together, and that's where you have to do the Google. And then these women go on Instagram and Twitter and they're kind of dropping hints about why the guys are terrible. But yeah, they end up doing these things because they have this show in the summer called Bachelor in Paradise. And basically that's starting to gear up filming within the next week, where a bunch of the former contestants, like 30 of them each summer, get together at a resort in Mexico and try to hook up. That's the whole premise of the show. Cast off losers from seasons go to Mexico to try to hook up and reform new relationships.
All right. Well, so my big question is, do they do a rose at the rose ceremony at the end of each episode?
Usually, but this past episode, because of all of the drama with the guy with the ex-girlfriend, they did a to be continued. So there was no rose ceremony. So I'm expecting
part two. I see.
Right. So I'm expecting Monday's episode to maybe have two rose ceremonies. So, and then I think it's going, I think the week after, because the NBA Finals, it's not going to air. So this maybe will be, if you want to get into The Bachelorette, I would say start with Monday. So you can kind of maybe use the week off to catch up.
Oh, there you go. There you go. So what do you think? Do you think that any of the Chicago guys are in trouble, like that could be bounced coming up on Monday?
Honestly, I would say some of them aren't making the best impressions. I don't think that they're standing out as well. I think if she's going on this one-on-one date with Anthony, I think he's got the best prospects to continue on. But Iggy getting out in the first round of the husband material challenge, and then, you know, Diggy not standing out during the basketball challenge, I don't think is good for them necessarily. And frankly, it's difficult to keep Iggy and Diggy.
I was going to say, that's the Chicago, the Chicago contributions are two guys named Iggy and Diggy. What are they? Are they twins from with letter jackets on, Letterman jackets? Like, hey, I'm Iggy and I'm Diggy.
I wish that they would do that because it is difficult keeping track of this many guys. This upcoming episode, besides the horseback riding, they also have a shirtless mud wrestling challenge.
Of course,
because that's the best way to find a husband. Yeah. And I definitely saw the clip, and I went through to make sure none of my guys were shown in this clip. And it's just difficult, especially when they're covered in mud. They really should be wearing Letterman's jacket.
Well, I know. I mean, that's how you found your husband, is they're mud wrestling. There was a lot of mud wrestling involved. I just know that that is a traditional way. It's just so funny how cliche that show is, so traditional in their dating. Pete, you watch the show. What's your takeaway?
Well, I watched the show, and I watched a little bit of the previous episode, and yeah, I was enamored with her dog, Copper. I love this little dog. It has a little cast on his like front right leg, and wasn't addressed. They didn't address the fact that the dog had a cast. And then like later in the episode, she goes on this one-on-one date and brings the dog along to this dog, you know, party, and the date. asks what happened to the dog, and she's like, oh, I don't want to talk about her. That'll come out later. So I was searching the internet for like 10 hours. I'm like, what is wrong with what's the real, did like an ex-boyfriend throw the dog off the, you know, I was like, and then like the next day she tweeted, like, you know, the dog like fell off, like hit his toe and jumping off something. But I was enamored with that dog.
Pete, you're in trouble if you're already Googling, but you're not even Googling the guys. You're Googling the dog on the show.
I was deep in finding out what's going on with that dog. You can't have this adorable dog show up with a blue cast and then not even say anything about it.
Yeah. So, Tracy, The Bachelorette, that's pretty much the only thing going on with Chicago. The other shows you mentioned, did anything specific happen on those shows that are worth noting?
We've got a nutritionist from the Ukrainian village who's on MasterChef.
Right.
She didn't show up on this past Wednesday's episode, but you'll see her fate and whether she makes it on the show this coming Wednesday. I've been covering Married at First Sight, which is the Chicagoans who married the strangers. It's the one on Lifetime. But I don't know. I watched this week's episode. It was really like slow as far as the plot. They kind of like blow up every sort of like arguments, and because these couples, they were strangers, you know, they meet at the wedding altar. Mm-hmm. And then they get married, and then they have 8 weeks to decide if they are going to stay together or get divorced. You really have to sit there and say, is this the argument that's going to lead to them wanting to get divorced?
Oh, right. A lot of red herring arguments, right.
Right, parking spaces, or who got invited to the wedding party, or fights with the family. Like, it's just like, is this going to snowball into something bigger? One of the couples has not even consummated the marriage weeks in, and it looks like they may be doomed. Dope. They also live in Barrington, so I don't know if that has anything to do with it.
Well, you know, this wasn't on our original agenda, but did you by chance check the series finale of River Monsters? Was that doesn't fit into the category? Because I want to know what happened. I missed that. And I know I was looking for a fish I think near Thailand.
I didn't see that, but I will say the season finale of The Amazing Race on Thursday, The Amazing Race finished at Wrigley. One of the challenges was at Wrigley, and then they finished at Olive Park. So it was kind of neat to see all the three remaining race pairs
running
finish up in Chicago.
Yeah,
they filmed last summer, and I always like to see how you know how other places come in and sort of see the city, and also it gave you another look inside Wrigley Field, and that seems to be happening more often as Wrigley Field making an appearance.
Yeah, there you go. Tracy Swartz is the ink columnist for the Chicago Tribune. She joins us weekly with our new segment Reality Check to update us on reality shows with Chicago connections. Tracy, thank you. Great job. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks, guys. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Michael Patrick Thornton. Coming up, he's been a guest on the show. I'm glad to have him back. Claire Kieschel also coming in. So get these guys in. Coming up here in the 10 o'clock hour, we're going to talk about the world premiere play Pilgrims, which is up at the Gift on the northwest side, 4802 North Milwaukee. Yeah, I mean, there are. It's really, really great that the street festival season is back. It's great. But there, it gets to a certain point, especially in June here in July, that they just start adding them on. I guess that's good for the city that there's a festival every second block. I mean, it's good for me when I'm bored on a Saturday afternoon, but it is getting kind of ridiculous. I did a piece for Cranes a couple years ago that was, they had asked me to write an editorial on why street festivals in Chicago aren't the best. Simple, right? Because everyone's always loves it. Street festival time, all these kind of things. And I was kind of making the joke about it. If you really like to eat a bratwurst on a curb next to the garbage, then yeah, street festivals are for you. For $9, get an $11 beer. It's great. I mean, I love them. Don't get me wrong. I do. But they're get to a certain point when there's nothing that specifically makes it different than, say, the one that's the next day or the one that's a couple blocks over, then you're really just eating, you know, fried meat on a stick and a $9 beer or sangria. Once in a while, I get sangria going. But I do. I might do Due Division this week. Why not, right? Although some of those, like Due Division, and I do like it a lot. I love Division Street. I love the whole thing. It's just there's a little bit of like, it's a kind of a go-to place for the hipsters. Like there's a, and if not hipsters, then, you know, just music lovers, adults, essentially. So it's not necessarily the most family-friendly after a certain hour, which is probably good for a street fest if you think about it. All right, coming up, we're going to talk with, like I said, Michael Patrick Thornton and Claire Kieschel. They're coming up right now. It's been a great week. Wow, it's amazing to think about. I've been talking about this for the last couple nights, that coming up next week is the Printers Row Lit Fest. And I got to say, I went crazy this year, because last year we had a couple of writers. I went R.L. Stine on, which was awesome. Kim Barker was on, a couple others as well. And I just remember, you know, when it was done, I was like, that was great. There were great guests. They only come in once in a while. It was really fun to be able to have sort of distinct, diverse conversations. But it was a lot of work. And then this year, I did the same thing. This time, I feel like my stomach is bigger than my eyeballs, or the other way around. My eyeballs are bigger than my stomach, in the way that, or my brain or whatever, because I booked 8 authors to come in next week. 8 authors from the Lit Fest. That means I have to read 8 books in a week. Is that even possible? Is that humanly possible? I just spent in the last 2 days, I've read 2. And one of which is just, I'm halfway through. And it's the, I've been talking about Hui 1968. It's really a nonfiction historical book about the Tet Offensive, Vietnam War. Not much, I'm going to be honest, I don't know too much about it. And I knew about it just based on, like I said, like, watching Full Metal Jacket or Platoon, or possibly, you know, history books, that kind of thing. But to read this 500-page biography of a battle, it's pretty intense. It gives you a whole different understanding and appreciation of what soldiers and commanders and civilians had to go through in that war, and specifically in that battle, because the city of Hue is a city. It's not unlike, you know, if you think about what you know about the Vietnam War, it was much about marshlands or jungles or converted bases that we created as the army. But this was a city. It was a cultural city, a destination. It also had a very historical city, very close to the border of the demarcation border of where North and South Vietnam were at. So it was a very surprising move in the Tet Offensive to have a sneak attack, a surprise attack like that. So it's a very interesting book, and like I said, I'm about halfway through it. But it's really good. It's really good, and I'm looking forward to it. But the problem is I really want to kind of savor the moment, and I find myself more often than not having to speed read this stuff because I know I have so many books I got to get to. But this one has caught my attention for 2 days now, and I've been reading it. It's really good. And like I said earlier in the show, it's weird because usually I have the discipline to read a book up to the point where we do the interview. Therefore, I can talk about the book and talk about the contents of the book with the author, and it's fresh. But because I've, like an idiot, booked 8 books, you know, authors that come through, I have to read in advance. So this is one for next Friday that I'm working on. But it's good, man. It's good. I wouldn't be surprised. It's the same author of Black Hawk Down. So I wouldn't be surprised if this we'll see this on the big screen. It has that kind of vibe to it. And his writing, his descriptive writing is just tremendous. I mean, it puts you right there and you feel like just the loss of humanity and the gore and everything that's involved with a battle, especially a battle in the late 60s in Vietnam. It's pretty crazy. All right, but that's coming up in a week. That's a joke. Tonight coming up, we'll talk the world premiere play of Pilgrims, which is going to be at the Gift on the Northwest side. We'll do that right after the break. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the world premiere play Pilgrims is opening this week at the Gift Theater on the Northwest side. It's a play written by critically acclaimed playwright Claire Kieschel and co-directed by Michael Patrick Thornton and Jessica Thebus, two great Chicago performers and directors and theater people. They've been around forever. The play takes place on a spaceship where a teenage girl and a soldier are heading out to start a new colony. And it really asks the question, not only what does it take to start a new society, but what does it take to be a pilgrim today? And did I mention there was a robot?
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun, dun.
In studio with me, Michael Patrick Thornton and Claire Kieschel. You guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
You guys are fresh off a rehearsal. That's how I like my guests.
We did about 80 miles an hour in the Kennedy to get here, and we're good. It's Claire's first time downtown Chicago.
It really is.
Oh. I came in here just for this. It's beautiful.
There you go. Well, let's start with you, Claire. Where does this story come from? Because, I mean, did I accurately sort of sum it up when you talk about what it takes to start a society?
I always think people talk about it so much better than I do. Which is, you know, the great thing about being a playwright, I just get other people to tell me about my work. But yeah, I was really interested in sort of, you know, we're in the midst of a kind of catastrophic kind of feeling of now. And people, I think, are thinking a lot about what is the new frontier. What is the new world?
Start a new world, what would it look like?
Right? Yeah, and what does it mean to be an American today? And sort of I was interested in thinking about, like, what, you know, the original Pilgrims as well, and sort of making that idea in a more sci-fi futuristic context.
You know, I always think about that, too, because you think about where it all kind of started, the idea of pilgrims coming here and sort of escaping tyranny or avoiding persecution, things of that nature. And you think about that today and the idea that where America is at as a country, but also, you know, if someone was going to do that today, where would you do that? I mean, one, A, you do it in space, but two, you know, why would you do it? Why? What would it be, you know, what would it take for you to start your own society?
Yeah, I mean, I always,
you know, it's funny because the the play is about space colonization, but I also kind of have this idea that I really believe that space colonization is still colonization and we shouldn't do it. because I think that a lot of times people have this fantasy of escaping our current world to make another one. And it is sort of a fantasy that allows for escapism opposed to looking at what
well, how
we
do
now.
You? I mean, if you're going to be in a situation where you're going, you have the opportunity to start anew, how do you keep things out of it? How do you keep the baggage out? How do you?
Exactly. It's hard to do, we can't. Yeah. We're humans. We're already, we've got it in our genes. I don't know. What do you think, Mike?
I'm just waving to people outside. I think those are all great points. I think the Puritans were our first refugees, so it's ironic that we have a stance of such kind of intractability against refugees because we were them too. And I think, yeah, wherever you go, there you are, is what the Buddhists say, and you can go to a different solar system, but the question is if you're running from something or running towards something.
Right.
And it's a little hard to discern the difference sometimes if you're still hurting. And that's one of the things I love about Claire's play is there's two people who are really they are survivors and they're still trying to survive, but you know not quite as perspicacious about if they've kind of turned the corner yet or not.
What was it about the play that drew you to it to want to be involved in not just at the GIFF but because you're artistic director there, but also to be involved in directing it?
I think first of all the play looked and felt unlike anything I'd ever seen before, simply on a literal sense looking. The dialogue is on the right-hand side of the page. The two characters play act during the play to pass the time. And when they're play acting, that dialogue's on the left-hand side of the page. There's no capitalization. It looks like a long poem in a way. And, you know, I go through about 300 plays a year to pick three. And there was no question with Pilgrims, none. If we see a play that we know how we would do it and who would probably get cast and who the designer would be and how the audience would respond, that play doesn't get picked.
Mm-hmm.
And this play set the bar even further past. It redefined kind of impossibility.
Claire, talk about that. I mean, it's the idea of avoiding the standards in which we know plays to be written in style and format. Now, what is it about those things that drew you to work away from that?
Well, I think the wonderful thing about theater is that theater really allows you to make its own form. So every play can have its own structure. And so I think for me, one of the things that gets me excited for every play that I write is to actually physically have it look different. It's sort of a game with myself, but it allows me also to sort of tell things to the actors without having to use things like stage directions or punctuation.
Is that a challenge? I mean, because you're going against the status quo.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's the fun thing about it, right? But I think in film and TV, you have to use final cut, final draft, and it's standard. And so I really think that theater is such a luxury and playwriting is such a luxury that you really get to sort of mess with that kind
of
format.
Is there a standard? I mean, I was just thinking about that because there are so many people who tell you exactly. I mean, when you think of Hollywood and you think of writing a screenplay, if you don't write it in a certain form, in a certain professional way that is, everything the right way, they discount it. They don't even talk about it. So how is that the same for theater, or theater will let you be as loose or creative as you want with the actual product?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think there are some exceptions to that rule. If you look at the screenplay for Taxi Driver, it's almost like a novel. It's written very, very, you can sort of see the inner thoughts of the character in the screenplay itself. But for theater, I think the new generation of playwrights are actually really challenging, I think, a lot of what conventional ideas of formatting used to be, because we're trying to have a different kind of... I think we're a generation that's interested in rhythm and interested in movement in a different way, mm-hmm. perhaps. And if you are able to sort of play with formatting, you're able to sort of use line breaks really to your advantage.
So, Michael, I mean, for you, like you said, 300 plays come in, you pick three. For you, how much of it is when you read something like that and it's something completely different than what you usually see? How hard is it to sell the rest of the company to tell everybody that, hey, we're going to do something that's different than the norm?
Well, I'm very fortunate. They don't tend to argue too much about the selection. I think, that they feel sorry because of the wheelchair maybe, and they just let me slide. But I mean, this play caused so much excitement. I mean, we had ensemble members who were like, I just want to play the robot. I don't care if I get cast in any other role this season. I just want the robot. And they were head over heels about it. It wasn't that hard. I think the kind of hidden ingredient in all the gifts, you know, 70 plays over 16 years, I think they're all love stories. I don't think they all look like love stories. Mm-hmm. I think that might be hard to put your finger on. But this one's a real dangerous love story. It's really beautiful. And I think America's having, as Claire said, a big reckoning with identity, you know, and who we ought to be. And I think, you know, since the earliest days when people stared up at the stars and were evading, you know, the woolly mammoth, story drawings on cave walls were our first way to kind of wrangle these massive questions of who we are and who we ought to be and how we ought to live with each other in a society. And that formed democracy. Theater formed democracy. Right. And I think Pilgrims points to a conversation that we're all going to have as we start mining rocks for new minerals. And right. Elon Musk wants to send us to Mars within a decade. We have to have a big conversation about what it means and what colonization means.
Yeah, and I think sci-fi as a genre, you know, I don't see a lot of it in theater. So it was really wonderful for the gift to do this mm-hmm. play because I think it is a risk, but I think it's exciting because it allows you to talk about these kinds of questions in these metaphysical, metaphorical ways. And how do you talk about the anxieties and traumas of the particular nation that we're in right now? And sci-fi ends up being like sort of a great, fun way to explore those things.
But at the core, I mean, Pilgrims is about the characters that are in that spaceship.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. I was really interested in seeing how, you know, PTSD is different also in a soldier versus a young woman with sexual assault who has experienced sexual assault, and seeing how you could put these two characters together in a room, not being able to escape that room. How do they sort of come to terms with their trauma together?
They can't escape while they're escaping.
Exactly.
There you go. Claire Kieschel is the playwright of the new world premiere play, Pilgrims, which is at the Gift Theater, 4802 North Milwaukee, co-directed by Michael Patrick Thornton, who's also here, and Jessica Thebus as well. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll continue the conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Patty Vasquez takes over. Talking about the world premiere play Pilgrims, which is opening next week at the Gift Theater on the Northwest Side. A play written by playwright Claire Kieschel, directed by Michael Patrick Thornton and Jessica Thebus. Michael Patrick Thornton and Claire Kieschel in studio tonight as we talk about the play. I'm interested in when you want to do science fiction and you want to put something like this on stage. And yet the whole story revolves around two characters. There's a robot. I don't want to say the robot's not important, because I'm sure the robot's important. Do you, as a director and as a playwright as well, both of you guys can answer this, do you really have to go against the idea of trying to throw a lot of sci-fi in there? You know, like try to let people know they're in space, do all this stuff that could potentially get in the way of what's happening between the characters.
It's a tenuous balance. I think, you know, we solved a lot of that in tech rehearsals, putting the lights and sound together. I think it's vitally important that we do feel like there is a ship and that it has its own laws. The engines work the same way when they're doing different kind of tests. But at the end of the day, that's not what plays are about. You know, as we said before, they're about people in a room. And so I think if those things are thought of carefully, it'll take care of itself. Mm-hmm. And then you can zero in on the story. And to Claire's point, I think science fiction is really anomalous in the sense that, like, it's such a great genre to kind of Trojan horse topics that people, you know, I mean, if someone saw an interracial couple kissing in the 60s on their street, their reaction is very different than watching Captain Kirk and Lieutenant Uhura kissing on their television, because it's removed from the present because right. it's the quote-unquote future. But, of course, it's not. It's a TV show. And it just has a magical way of opening up people's sense of identity, and this is what I believe, because we're like, oh, this is the future. I'm probably dead.
Let me ask you that. I mean, how important is for both of you guys as theater professionals when you talk about writing and directing a play? How important is space? How important is place? The idea that, I mean, the concept that you're going to have this relationship, and like you said, some of the things are going to be explored, whether it's PTSD and other issues. But how important is it to be in the right space or place for that conversation to happen?
In terms of the physical properties of the theater, or
no, I mean in the story.
Yeah, I think it's so important, and I think I start often from what I want it to look like or what it to feel like. And I think what you said, Michael, is really right. And the great thing about genre too, and about sci-fi, is that people come with their own ideas and history with sci-fi. So what I've been finding really interesting is that people just bring, they fill in their own worlds. Like, we're such imaginative, you know, people, and we're so well versed in narrative right now that we actually do a lot of this work. So we actually just need, you can use very few elements and people will fill in all of it for themselves. And I think there's a great thing about the pleasure of theater as opposed to film, that you really get to do those, for every audience member gets to sort of fill in the world and the world outside the spaceship in their own brains.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, I think in the best plays, and certainly at put Pilgrims in there, the setting is another character, in the sense that it sort of has a point of view, and the characters react to it in certain ways, and it brings out stuff in them that might not come out in their everyday setting. And you know, our space is very intimate. We're the most intimate Equity Theater in Chicago at 40 seats, and you feel like you're in that room, you know. And there's a bed in the room, amazing. There's a hallway and a bathroom, and there's no furniture and two people and a robot. And the ship in the room, if you do it right, they should be another character. So it really should be like a 4 or 5-person play.
You know, as your play gets produced and it's a world premiere, when you're in that kind of setting where it's a very intimate space and the gift is up there on Milwaukee, is that how you intended it? I mean, when you think about, do you think as a writer about how you would want to see this play actually mounted?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's different with every play, but this play specifically is such an intimate play that really does depend on two people and their performances, that part of the reason I was so excited that The Gift was going to do this play was that close proximity to the audience, and that the audience themselves start to feel claustrophobic and excited and taking off in the same kind of way that you can in a ride at Disney World or something.
Interesting, yeah. Well, I mean, I wonder, because as you talk about theater being an intimate experience, right? And then on top of it, having this intimate experience in the way that you're in a smaller space. I mean, is it harder for you, Michael, to go in any other direction when you have a small space? I mean, the idea of if the play called for it to be expansive, or to, I don't know what the opposite of intimate would be, cold.
Cold. Yeah.
But I mean, would it be harder for you to do if in the space that you're doing? Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I guess that's the one big thing about my job in selecting these shows is, will our space augment the virtues of the play, or will it hamper them? And if it's the latter, then it would be irresponsible to do it, you know? And so, yeah, it would be great to have the real estate to do, you know, Angels in America or some huge set crazy play. But we're not there yet. I think what helps is that, unlike sometimes small theaters can be abused in the sense of, like, we have you here, we're so close to you, you're not going anywhere, you know. I don't think that's what theater is, and that's not what The Gift aesthetic is. You know, we show up for the benefit of the, as we call them, the noble dreamers in the dark, the strangers, the audience. That's why we show up, and, you know, nothing survives us, you know, the reviews, and that's it. And it's a very ephemeral calling, you know. And so I think if you have that ideology and that approach to making art in an intimate space, I think you're on a good track, and we're still here 16 years later.
Yeah, and I gotta say, you know, when you think about the different mediums that you can produce art in, and you think about theater, and you think about the experience of having this moment with the actors, and moments with the words and the play, and the moments with the people who are sitting next to me, and that's a moment that can never ever be replicated. there's something to that in the way that that's not, I don't know, to this day, I can't think of another art form that compares.
Yeah, it's a down payment on humanity. You know, you trust you trust that they'll carry it on, complete it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something about theater that's always, you can never see it again, so it's always like a little bit like death. You have to hold on to it. It's like TV is adolescence, movies are coming to age and adulthood, and TV's really about, I mean, theater's really about death.
Well, I mean, for both of you, have worked in different mediums. I mean, you've worked both in TV, film, and theater. I mean, is there, what are the differences? I mean, when you think about, you know, your life in front of the camera, but then also on stage, do you approach the work differently? Do you think as an artist differently when working in different medium?
Sure. I think, well, everything that one of our ensemble members, Erica Weiss, who directed me in this film, The View from Tall, always talked about, everything that's kind of a given in theater, of like the order of the scenes, where they take place, who your scene partner is, all that in film and TV can change at the drop of a dime or hat or whatever the idiom is. I should have eaten something. Because of the business, you know, actors will get recast or locations become unavailable. And it can be a very cold environment to try to make art that you want to be somewhat eternal or something. Mm-hmm. So I actually love film and TV because I think it really makes me practice what I preach, which is if I sit across from my scene partner and my work has been prepared and I tell the truth about them and I'm willing to be vulnerable, then actually that should be enough to survive as a document of that moment, because that's what it actually was.
As a writer, Claire, is it similar?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I also will say about the thing that's great about the gift and the intimacy there is that you are able to be as close to the actors' faces as you would in on a screen.
Right, right.
So you're that close that nothing gets by. So I love that kind of intimacy that you're able to do at the gift, that I think is actually very similar to some of the things that you're able to do with, you know, moment-to-moment work in film and TV.
I just always wonder, you know, because we were just talking about this. Chris Witaski was on, he's on the show Love on Netflix. And he talked about, he had an improv background, Second City guy, and this was in the realm of comedy. But the idea that when he's on stage almost all the time doing improv in L.A., you know, the goal is to make the people in the audience have an emotional response.
Mm.
And when he's in the room on Love or you know, another show or anything where it's a space, there's no audience, you know, they can't have an emotional response. You can't make the grip laugh. You can't make the people behind the camera cry or whatever the emotion you're going for. That it's a different, almost like a different skill or a different, it's like left hand, right hand in a way when it comes to performance.
The weird thing is I think there's a lot of playwrights that are getting into TV and film now, partly because I think you learn how an audience reacts to your work moment to moment in theater so well that then you can translate that to TV and film.
You have confidence, right?
And you're able to sort of know how an audience might react to this 6 months, you know, after post-production, react to these moments. But you're also always surprised.
Right. It's interesting, right?
Yeah, I think, and as an actor, you know, I try to think of who's on the other side of the lens, you know, who's going to be receiving it from their television in a few months. My best friends and my family, and you end up performing for them. That's who the camera kind of transforms for you, is you just kind of collapse space-time a bit, and you put your loved ones in the room with you on this crazy cold set where people are worried about if you're going to make the day, and you just kind of have to silence all that and remind yourself why you showed up in the first place.
Yeah. Michael Patrick Thornton in studio along with Claire Kieschel. We're talking theater. We're talking about the world premiere play Pilgrims, which is opening next week at the Gift Theater on the Northwest Side, 4802 North Milwaukee. And we will continue that conversation. We'll take a break. We'll come back with Claire and Michael in studio. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Claire Kieschel, the playwright, and Michael Patrick Thornton, the director of the world premiere play Pilgrims, is opening next week at the Gift Theater on the Northwest Side, 4802 North Milwaukee. The opening is the 8th, right?
That's correct.
That's right. And Jessica Thebus is your
co-director.
All right. I saw you wince over there. I didn't properly give credit to the
medium-sized wince.
It's a medium-sized And I, you know, I've been saying all show, I was like, you were one of my first guests on the download.
Yeah.
Yeah. We did a big table a couple years ago now.
I'm a download veteran now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were talking about the importance of place to theater. We were talking about the importance of the idea of where you're performing, the actor's performance, whether it's to a camera or to a stage or to an audience. How important is time? You know, when you talk about a play like this, Pilgrims, it has a lot to do, from what I can tell, and I haven't seen the play, but what we've been talking about, this concept of colonization and where we're at as a country, but also as a planet, and this idea of we can't really escape what we've had before, but what are we going to do to reconcile out in space? You know, obviously there's political overtones and things like that. Do you run the risk, or not the risk, is there a challenge in making it relevant to the moment if the moment shifts? Meaning, you know, like in 10, 15 years, maybe there's a pro-Mars president that changes the way that this play is. I mean, do you think about that as a playwright, the idea of how time affects your work?
Completely. I think there's a real risk and danger sometimes to being wanting to write a play that responds right to this moment right now. And I know a lot of playwrights were like, after the election, let's write a play about this right now. But the problem with writing about something that is so contemporary is that you're correct, that it's only going to last for that certain amount of time. And then it's going to be more of a historical document.
Or interpreted differently.
Or interpreted differently, exactly. Right. So I think something, if you're talking about big ideas, hopefully they're going to be able to be interpreted in different ways throughout the years, in ways that are going to surprise you. And that's definitely happened to me, that people have seen things in my plays that I certainly didn't intend, but I always am happy to hear it.
I mean, for you as a director, I mean, do you have to think about that? Because theater still continues to be representative of its time, meaning it's current, it's relevant, it's a great place to hash out ideas that are happening for real in the world around us. Does time play a role when you're thinking about what you're going to put up on stage in The Gift or what you might direct?
Yeah, I guess I think about time in the sense of how much time do we have to make it? You know, like The Gift we rehearsed David Rabe's Hurly Burly for over a year.
Wow.
And we didn't leave the table for 6 months. Now, I don't advocate that as a rule, that we just kind of blundered into that. This year is very different because we're on a different equity contract. So we had 3 weeks of rehearsal. We were used to about 8 weeks of rehearsal. How you make things in terms of time fascinates me. My wife's a performance artist, so she's done things where she sits on a table with a 100-pound block of ice for 8 hours until it melts. Wow. Perturbing those ideas of time is interesting. And I think, you know, as an artistic director, I think if you're too worried about things being current, I think it's a great way to go bankrupt, because things do change so fast. You know, we don't need any reminder of that, you know. Yeah. And so you're hoping that you're going to have a conversation about a question that you yourself have not figured out, and that is a genuine offering to strangers in the dark of, hey, this is something that really baffles me and I'm scared of. So I'm going to put on the table and we can all sort of talk about it under the lights.
Well, there's a distinction. And as a playwright, I would assume that this is the distinction between time and relevancy.
Yeah.
In the way that you want to be relevant to the issues that we're talking about. And it doesn't really necessarily have to reflect the time that we're in.
Completely right. And sometimes the plays that are most relevant can, you know, think of The Crucible by Arthur Miller. It was incredibly relevant talking about, you know, communism in the 50s and was set in the Salem witch trials. You know, that it actually became more relevant by setting it in a historical time period.
You know, as you talk about Pilgrims, and that the name of the play, and obviously the concept of being in a spaceship and really tackling big questions like, what does it mean to start a society? What would it mean to be a pilgrim today? You know, do you talk about why those are questions that resonate with you as not just a playwright, but as an American, as a artist? What is it about that concept of, you know, starting something anew that made you write this?
Yeah, I think I've always been fascinated by the American dream. I grew up abroad for 8 years, and so I had a little bit of an outsider's perspective when I moved back to the States of what it really was and what it meant to be an American and what this sort of fantasy we have of what it means to be a good American, what it means to live the right kind of life. And so I think that that was always something that was really interesting to me, and I think that as Americans, we're also people that constantly want new adventures and exploration, and I'm interested in what are also the consequences of that kind of need in mm-hmm. ourselves, and how can that hurt other people sometimes, but yet we still have to contend with those desires within ourselves.
Michael, what from this play, I mean, it's one thing to read it and pull it out, but as an artistic director, a theater artist, and also a human being, what were the things that grabbed you? What
the last one's debatable.
It's debatable. What draws you to this personally, to Pilgrims?
I think the great question that Pilgrims asks, and it's a very personal question to me, beyond disability stuff, in the realm of psychology, and is how do we heal? And that to me is the emotional landscape yeah. that it's grown out of, and that I zeroed in on as a co-director and a artistic director. And I think, I think Americans don't do really well talking about trauma. I don't think Americans do really well talking about mental illness. I think it's still the boogeyman, one of the great boogeymen of our culture. And I think theater and science fiction is a great delivery system to actually have those conversations in a safe space.
Right.
And so that's what I really, really hooked into. How do we heal?
How do we heal? Playwright Claire Kieschel and co-director Michael Patrick Thornton, who's co-director with Jessica Thebus. The world premiere play Pilgrims, opening on June 8th. At the Gift Theater on the Northwest Side, 4802 North Milwaukee. The play takes place on a spaceship, and there is a robot. That is the tagline.
Hey, perfect. Brittany Birch's robot. We've got Ed Flynn, Janelle Villas. It's just great.
All right. You know, I can't thank you guys enough. Thanks for coming in, doing a little
thank
late
so
night
much for having
talk
us.
Radio.
This is great. Tonight.
Great fun. To see you again, Michael. That's going to do it tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up next. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. It's a good week.